Okay, I make it 9 o'clock, so we can make a start. So thank you very much indeed for joining us today. It really is terrific to see so many people here to come and listen to what we have to say about Rolls-Royce. I sometimes wonder when I issue these invitations whether many people are that interested or whether people are going to turn up. So it really is terrific, really terrific to see so many people here. And I know we have many people joining us listening in on the phone lines, and we'll be WebExing the whole presentation. So thank you very much indeed. First of all, let me introduce my colleagues on the podium here. I think you probably know most of them, but just to make sure. First of all, Mark Morris, who's our CFO. Tony Wood, who's president of our aerospace division. Colin Smith, who's our engineering director. And Laurie Haynes on the far right, who's president of our marine and industrial power systems business. And they're here, Tony and Mark, to make presentations. And Colin and Laurie and the rest of the team to answer questions a little later. First of all, I should read our safe harbour statement. Please remember that while today is not a trading update and while we are not issuing any new guidance, we will be talking about the future and our view of the group's prospects. This includes our current assumptions that, of course, can change, and therefore any forward-looking statements should be considered in that light. The purpose of today is to start to address some of the issues that many of you have raised about Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce is a complicated business. We understand that you need help understanding it, and we know that we need to give you more help so that you can understand us better and do your jobs better and help us do our jobs better. So the purpose of today is to start that. And I say the word start because I know, you know, we all know that we're not going to answer everybody's questions in a single investor day meeting, but I believe that we can make a good start today. With that in mind, we have already planned another date for our second investor meeting this year. So a date for your diaries will be October the 21st, when we'll have a meeting in Norway in our marine centre in Alesund, where we'll focus primarily on our marine business. And then next year we'll have another two sessions, one of which will focus on our aerospace business, and then I think everybody will be pleased to learn that we're going to take you all to Friedrichshafen and talk about our high-speed reciprocating business, Rolls-Royce Power Systems, formerly Tognum, out in Germany. So we're going to make a start today. We've got plans for the future to help you get more familiar with the company. Today, I'm going to discuss something around strategy. Mark will talk about capital allocation and guidance. Tony and Mark will talk about total care accounting. We'll take a break after Mark Morris has talked about capital allocation and guidance, about 20 minutes. We'll come back, talk about total care, and then we'll run a Q&A session up until lunchtime. A couple of headlines from this morning, which you will all, I'm no doubt, have read, but worth saying. First of all, we said in our RNS that we have no plans for any material M&A at present. Secondly, we said that we would return the proceeds from the sale of our energy division by way of a share buyback. Mark will talk a little bit more about that later on. And thirdly, we confirmed the guidance that we'd issued to the market. Now, I'm going to take you through a number of slides that talk about our strategy. But I thought, before I do that, I'd just start by saying, you know, how I would reflect on our business with a few points. Concentrate on what we're good at and where we add value. Concentrate on supporting our customers through the life cycle of the product. Invest in technology. Concentrate on growth markets with barriers to entry. Create a portfolio of products that have some common and some complementary characteristics. Execute effectively and efficiently. I would say we've got plenty of opportunity in the future. So, strategy, evolution, not revolution. We started to use some new words to describe our strategy, which we've changed, and we've changed them for a number of reasons to try to simplify it so that the organisation understands it, but it doesn't change what we're trying to do. It's just how we talk about it. And we talk about our strategy now really around customer innovation and profitable growth. Customer, the heart of the business. Understanding intimately what our customers' needs and requirements are is essential. It's essential for any business. We have to absolutely be clear on what our customers want, what they need, and how we can help them. Innovation. The company has built its strength on innovation. The position that we have today has been earned because of the technology, the way that we do things. We are terrific at innovation. The great trick is to make sure that the innovation we do is what customers want. It's to link those two things closely together. If we innovate to provide customers with what they want, it will be successful. If we just innovate for the sake of doing something new, it is unlikely to be. So the important link between the two is that they're connected, and that's why understanding our customers is so important. And profitable growth, both words being important. It isn't just about profit, it isn't just about growth, it's about growing profitably. It's absolutely essential. So nothing particularly new, just a different way of expressing our strategy compared to the past. And what a past. In the last decade, order books gone from nearly 19 billion to nearly 72 billion, up nearly four times. Revenues increased nearly three times from 5 to 15 billion, and profits up about six times from 0.3 to 0.6. What intrigues me a little bit is if I went back to 2003 and looked at our position there, I suspect that most people wouldn't have believed that that was possible. I suspect that. And what I would suggest is that we have a stronger portfolio, a stronger position today because of the work that's been done, so that we should look forward to the future with greater confidence than we would have done in 2003. Who are we? Rolls-Royce is a complex power systems and services group. That's what we've done, that's what we do, that's what we will do. We've always done it, we are doing it, we will do it. We haven't changed. If I go back to our original memorandum of understanding, it was to provide power for vehicles for use on land or water or in the air. And that was in the memorandum in 1904. That's still what we do today. It's what we've done, what we do, what we'll continue to do. We're not changing. The power comes from three sources: gas turbines, reciprocating engines, and to a small extent, nuclear. That's where our power comes from. And again, if you went back in history of the company, the very first engine that Rolls-Royce produced was, of course, a reciprocating engine. So whilst we all think of Rolls-Royce as being gas turbines, actually, if you look at the history and what we've done and where we've been, reciprocating engines and gas turbines have been a common theme for many, many years, and nuclear since the middle of the 50s. Systems. We don't just do power, we have a number of other products. Lift fan, for example, and the Joint Strike Fighter. In marine, we probably have the best portfolio of systems products, whether that's propellers, thrusters, water jets, winches, deck equipment, dynamic positioning systems, ship design, of anyone in that market. And of course, services. Services run across the whole of the group. Very, very important to us. Look after the product through its life cycle. Provide those services. From an organizational perspective, we've divided ourselves into two: an aerospace division, and marine and industrial power systems. And underneath those, we have the businesses of civil aerospace, defense aerospace, Rolls-Royce Power Systems, formerly Tognum, marine, and our nuclear businesses. If I look at it looking across some of the connections between aerospace and marine, there are many. So in the marine business, we learned a lot from our aerodynamics in terms of propeller, how we could improve the propellers. We designed and invented a contra-rotating propeller, but that was based on our knowledge of aerodynamics. In our aerospace division, we learned from cavitation in the marine industry about how to improve our aero fuel pumps. We learn a lot across the two between bearings and seals from marine to aerospace. We learn about composite materials, bonding processes between the two. Underneath this, we have an infrastructure which supports both. The advanced manufacturing research centres, the way that we analyse, the methods that we use, the processes, the production systems, all those are common across the group. So whilst we organise ourselves in this way, there are strong links between the two. And we foster those strong links by moving people across the organisation to bring learning and different thinking from aero to marine or to marine industrial power systems and back and the other way. This is not just two separate businesses completely separated. They are together. I've already said we've grown revenue a lot. If I look at 2003, our marine industrial power systems business was 27% of the total revenue. Not small. It's grown since then. I would say we've got a better balance in revenue. But we've grown our revenue hugely, got a better balance. If I look at profit, it's the same story. Back in 2003, small profits, mostly aerospace, but then MIPS was 16%, 30% today. Over that period of time, not only have we grown the profits, but the margins have almost doubled. And in every single business unit, the margins have gone up. So I would suggest that we've done well in terms of growing the business and improving the business's financial performance. We've been pretty good owners of those businesses. In terms of where the revenue comes from, as you would expect, this chart, mostly gas turbines. Reciprocating engines, about 19%. Marine equipment, 11%. Nuclear, relatively small at 4%. Nuclear is an important business for strategic reasons, I think, within Rolls-Royce. Lots of growth opportunity on the civil side of nuclear as we look forward in terms of the UK civil build. But for strategic reasons, it's very important. You know, in the last couple of days, the Chinese Premier was discussing nuclear and we were involved in those discussions. It has a bigger impact for the group than the size of the revenue. Marine equipment, very important. If we look at it in terms of OE and aftermarket, again, no surprise for you. You're familiar with this, roughly 50-50. But the marine industrial power systems part is relatively small compared to the aerospace. We are learning from aerospace into here to grow this business. And in fact, Laurie and his team in the marine business sold their first equivalent to total care package to one of our customers about 3 or 4 months ago. Again, we learn across the business. Now, if I look at our civil gas turbine business and our reciprocating businesses, and just look at what I call some of the characteristics of those businesses, it was quite interesting. First of all, I would say that the return on capital employed is about the same. And this isn't just ours. We've looked around the industry, we've looked at the market, and we've created an assessment in conjunction with some outside help. So we've got a common, similar return on capital employed. But the characteristics are very different. Again, no particular surprise to anyone. Barriers to entry in this market, very high. Investment, high. Time to earn cash, high. No surprises. Different in this one. Shorter. And when I come to look around the industry, it comes as no particular surprise to me, and I suspect nor to you, that there are no pure play civil businesses when you look at these kind of characteristics. So, let me sort of pause for a second there. I tried to give you an overview of where we've been, what we've been doing, and why, and to give you some indications of the characteristics of the business. And I guess what I'm saying is we're doing what we've always done. Because there's been quite a lot of speculation or feeling in the market that we're diversifying or doing something different. And we're not. We're doing more of what we've always done. Let me move on and talk about our priorities. Again, these should all be familiar to you. I will be astonished if you were surprised by any of these. The top two, fix the basics, the four C's. Everybody in the organisation is familiar with them. I think most people here will be familiar with them. And culture. I've called those the bedrock. In some ways, they're not strategic, but if we don't get them right, delivering the strategic investment choices is more challenging. And the bottom three, wide body gas turbines, narrow body, and medium speed recips. I think I've talked to all investors, I think I've talked to everybody about this list being the list of priorities that we have. Just run through them. Four C's, customer, concentration, cost, and cash. Let's just run through those. I'm going to just run through this chart. I'm going to start on the right, your left, over here, and then come back to here. On-time delivery to customer. In the past, when we were making very few engines, this was not a particularly important matter. It was always sort of important, but it wasn't a hugely important issue. As our volumes have increased, as a consequence of our success, it becomes really important. We're improving across the business. And as I've said to many of you, last year, for the first time ever in civil large engines, we were 100% on time all through the year. In the other businesses, it's improved through the year. So these are year-end numbers, but the story is the same, whatever numbers I use. The good news is we're improving. And this is absolutely essential because it transforms the discussions that I have with customers from discussing problems of the past to talking about opportunities in the future. And it's not just in delivery that we're changing it. We have what we call the customer DNA in the organisation, and there's us just over there. It sort of shows the four things that we worry about: quality, delivery, responsiveness, and reliability. And we're improving in all of those. In fact, we won an award from Airbus, and Boeing have really been complimentary most recently about our quality. Terrific improvement. Delivery, I'm showing you, is improving. Our responsiveness to issues has improved. And our reliability, as Tony will talk about, is also improving. So we're making very, very good progress in terms of satisfying our customers, which means that we can focus on what I would regard as more important discussions for Rolls-Royce. How can we do more to help you? How can we win more business? Clearly, if you're not satisfying them, winning more business is a problem. So that's really good. This side, internal plan delivery. What I've said to many people is the only good news that I can find in these kind of numbers is that they're improving, but none of them are acceptable. Changing this is very hard. It drives back into our supply chain. It drives back into the way that we manufacture. Everything about it is hard to change, but it is heading in the right direction and continues to head in the right direction. So when some of you say, well, why aren't you making more progress on cost and cash? I'm afraid this is one of the reasons. We've got to fix this to make some progress on cost and cash. And we are fixing it. But as we fix this and drive this towards 100%, what we've also then got to do is narrow the gap between the plan and the delivery. Because the only way we get to the delivery, to the customer on time, when you've got these kind of numbers, is by having a big buffer of material, time, and everything else you can think of. You can't do it any other way. Now, again, to give you some encouragement, and give me some encouragement, we're making progress. So on our Trent 700, we've improved our lead time by about 19% in the last year. So we're about 19 days compared to 20-odd, and we're targeting to get to 15. We're making progress, a lot more work to do. Concentration, something that I feel very strongly about. Making sure, as I said at the start, that we concentrate on what we're good at and where we add value. That's what this is about. We've got out of some businesses for a variety of reasons that you're familiar with, whether it's to do with scale or not core competency, and we're focusing on businesses where we have core competency and where what we're good at. our business is complicated enough without being distracted. Don't get distracted. Focus on what you're good at. Cost. We are attacking cost across the organisation, everywhere, all the time. I've said to many of you, when I first started talking about this, it took a while for the organisation to get its head around it. And that was, in my view, because we sort of had record revenue, record profits, record order book, record share price. We're a successful company. What are you talking about? We're making progress on that. If you went anywhere in our organisation now, people get the cost message. They've got it. They understand it's important. We're making progress. So run through a couple of these things on the slide. We've got about 600 engineers focusing on cost reduction, about 400 on original equipment, looking at our existing products, driving costs down in our existing products. And they're making good progress. And what we're finding is we are offsetting the escalation that we're getting through the supply chain with the cost reductions that these guys are generating. We've got a couple of hundred engineers working on the aftermarket, and they're actually driving costs down in absolute terms. We've got a lot of people working on this. It's really important to us. Low-cost country sourcing. We're about 20% at the moment on average, slightly higher in the marine and industrial power systems business than in the aerospace business. We're targeting 40% by 2020. 20% lower footprint by 2020. We've opened a lot of new plants and a lot more capacity as a consequence of the growth that we know is coming. And we're driving performance in those plants as we planned. So let me give you an example. In Sunderland, we used to have one man looking after a machine. We've now got one man looking after three machines. For our fan discs, we have reduced the lead time from 60 days to 10 days in the new plant. The new plant in Sunderland has about double the productivity of the old plant. And that is consistent with many of the manufacturing facilities that we have created, the new facilities. So that's fantastic. It's exactly what we wanted to do. It's why we've been investing money in new facilities. But what we're going to have to do is now close out the old and tired estate, because that is clearly a cost that we're carrying at the moment. So over the coming years, we think we will take out 20% of our footprint. We've got many new projects in our advanced manufacturing research centres, whether that's around additive layer manufacturing, whether it's metal injection, moulding, many, many new projects coming to help improve our productivity. Our logistics costs. Total logistics cost for roles about £300 million. I think we can reduce that by 20%. Again, to give you an example, in our large engine business, what we found when we looked into the detail of it is that many of our inbound components are visiting three or four warehouses and being handled 12 to 14 times. Nonsense. We need to change that. We can do. There's lots of opportunity in the logistics costs. We'll continue to improve inventory turns. We need to reduce our time to market of new products and, as it says here, adopt automotive industry practices, which is, you know, a long way ahead of us. We reduce our indirect headcount. Business process optimization. This is the sort of transaction processing stuff. Again, big opportunity for us there in terms of transforming what we do, whether that's outsourcing, offshoring, making more efficient, rationalizing. Lots of opportunity, working hard on that. So across the business, there are opportunities, frankly, everywhere, and we are making progress on those opportunities. Cash. We've got to drive our CapEx down. And we're talking about 4% rather than the current 4.9% in the 3 to 5 year time period. In terms of research and development, I think I've said to everybody who's asked me, I would expect it to ease as a percent of revenue, but nothing more than that. It's our lifeblood. It's what we do. It's really important to the future of the group. And inventory, we're driving inventory turn rates, as you saw. Last year, we went from 3 to 3.4 turns, from 3 and 12 to 3.4, which is the biggest increase we've had as an organisation, and we improved across many of the divisions. We're driving further improvements in inventory turns this year. we'll increase it again. Culture. There's a quote that I like. I'm not certain where it came from, but I've seen it many times. It's somewhere from the US, which is culture eats strategy for breakfast. The culture in Rolls-Royce, I've sort of referred to it, which is we're a really successful company. Why do we have to worry about cost? Well, we have to worry about cost. We're getting it. We're changing the culture in the company. Traditionally, we've been great at innovation, and we've got to retain that culture. But we need to become, if you like, more business-orientated, a more business-focused culture, one that understands our customer and our costs, and we're making progress on that. We're changing the way that people think about the business, act and behave. Culture is just about behaviours. What's important? Clearly, we've got some ethics issues that you're all aware of with the SFO. We are working hard on those. We've got a new code of conduct. We've got something that we call the passport, which is describes what is or isn't acceptable in terms of behaviours, what's important around here. We, management team, spend a lot of time in the organisation because those kind of unethical behaviours are completely unacceptable to me, to the board, and we will not tolerate them. We've hired Lord Gold, who's helping us make sure that we have the right policies and procedures in place, and has been a terrific help over the last year. We're addressing this issue. It's a serious issue. We're taking care of it. Okay, wide bodies. This is an external wide body forecast. I think if I pick most wide body forecasts for the next decade, there will be something pretty similar to this. The headline number that gets me is in the last decade, about 2,000 deliveries, in the next decade, 4,000 deliveries. So huge growth in this market. It's an important market. And, you know, people, and you may ask today, well, what about cancellations? We just saw how much, you know, yeah, there'll be cancellations and there'll be new orders. But the scale of the change, the scale of delivery is significant. And I would suggest that this is not a bubble. It's driven by real demand. So what's happening in the airline industry to create this? Well, I would suggest two things, really. First of all, the huge increase in fuel prices, which means that fuel for wide-bodied aircraft carriers is now the most significant cost item that they have to deal with, whereas historically it was always labour. So what they're looking at is replacing their old kit with new kit and some capacity expansion because of the cost of fuel, and the new kit is much more fuel efficient than the old stuff. So fuel drives part of the change. The second one, of course, is our emerging markets. Huge demand for growth there. I'm sure if any of you go on holiday anywhere, you'll be meeting Chinese people. 4 or 5 years ago, you wouldn't have met them on holiday. You will now, because they're traveling more and more and more and more. Huge growth in China, as an example, but it's across the emerging markets. Huge demand for travel, huge growth potential, huge demand. So I don't think it's a bubble. I think it's real, and I think we will see this kind of growth. So what does that mean for us? Pretty similar, really. In the last decade, we delivered about 1,600 Trent engines. We think in the next decade, we're going to deliver about 4,000. So that's consistent with us having about 50% of the market, consistent with the growth of the wide-body aircraft. So let me talk a little bit about this chart. This chart attempts to sort of show the trajectory of our Trent deliveries from where we are today here in 2014 to where we'll be in the future. A few observations about this. Growth in 2015 starts picking up in 16 and 17. You know why? XWB ramp up. So we're the only engine on the A350. The A350 enters service at the end of this year. Slow ramp up in 15, not really starts going in 16. The 1,000 comes in 17. More ramp up, more volume. That's what's driving those changes. So that's the first observation that I would make. The second observation I would make is that within this ramp up, there will be ups and downs. And there'll be ups and downs because things happen. So the A350 program is going really, really well. Certainly from the engine perspective and everything I hear from Airbus, going well. Great level of confidence. But if there was a slippage, that would shift that way. And because the ramp-up happens through the year, you get more volume of XWBs, as far as we're concerned, in the fourth quarter than you do in the first or second quarter. So it moves to the right. If we were looking at this chart 5, 6, 7 years ago, we wouldn't have the kind of number of Trent 700s in there for the A330, because everyone thought the Trent 700s and the A330 would have finished production because the 787 was coming. The 787, as you all know, was delayed. Therefore, we still got Trent 700s being delivered, and the A330 is going well. So this changes. It changes year to year. A380s for us. We were more optimistic about sales, I think, than that, in terms of volumes last year than we are at the moment. We'll see how that plays out. So over this period of time, we'll get some volatility. We still get to this, because the volatility that I'm talking about is around the ramp-ups. It's around short-term changes. It isn't around the long-term direction of growth. So put a different way, we've got sustainable growth in our business, but it doesn't mean it's going to be consistent year on year on year. This is where we will end up, because that's the volume of wide-bodied aircraft. We're the only engine on the A350. We're one of two on the 787. We're one of two on the A380. We are the primary seller on the A330. So the direction of travel is clear. The exact route to get there will have some bumps on it, I'm sure. One other observation. I've talked a little bit about cash. I've talked a little bit about some of the work that we're doing on costs. If, as all of you are interested in, is sort of cash conversion, as we get through that peak, that is really where I'd be looking at for a change in the level and the rate of cash conversion. Dependent, of course, of whether we have another huge program at that point in time. If I look at this in terms of installed thrust, again, a chart that many of you have seen before, huge growth in thrust over this period. And, yeah, again, a couple of observations that you're well aware of. The longevity of these programs, this is where real value is in Rolls-Royce. So this light blue here is the Trent 700, the A330. Still there in 2023. And whilst the RB211 is going down from here to here and changing, there'll still be RB211s in 2023. We've got nothing on the XWB today. This projection says it's going to be about 34% at that point in time. So when I was saying earlier, if you go back to 2003 and look at the platforms and the positions that we had then, and you look at where we are today, with the XWB, the Trent 1000 in particular, in terms of volume growth, coupled with the success that we've had on the Trent 700, we're in a very different place. So we're going to get lots of growth. And the relationship revenue-wise from OE to aftermarket, again, as I think you're familiar with, is about 4 to 1. 4 for the aftermarket, 1 for OE. And thrust is not a bad proxy for revenue. Future products. I've said a couple of times that R&D is essential for the company. We're great at innovation. We're great on the technical side. We announced in February 2 new products, and I think that whilst we're not a marketing company, the names of them are quite marketing. Advance and UltraFan sounds impressive, at least to me. We're investing in new technology, and we have to do this. There's sometimes some people I meet, they think we can stop and start and start. You can't in this game. It is a constant requirement to remain what we term internally as being match fit. You've got to keep training. You've got to keep the capabilities. You can't afford to lose it. Most of the capabilities is people, or are people. You don't lay them off and bring them back. And even if you could do that, they would only remember what they had in the past. They need to constantly be learning, constantly developing. So these two new engines, they've got a variety of new technologies in them, from composite fan cases, fan blades, advanced ceramic matrix composites, lean burn technology, and as we go out to the ultra fan power gearbox. This drives fuel efficiency, which is what the carriers crave. We'll continue to invest in new technology. We will not get behind. We will stay in front. Narrow body. About 7 or 8 years ago, Rolls was faced with a difficult decision, which is that there were four new engines required, which turned out to be the Trent 900, Trent 1000, the XWB for the A380, 787, and A350. And there was one called the Neo for the A320 family. And Rolls sort of looked at this and said, actually, we've only got the resources to do three of the four. Which should we do? We chose to do, obviously, the big three, not the fourth. So we didn't have the resources, capacity at that time to do the Neo. Fast forward to a couple of years ago, we exited our joint venture IAE. And we exited it because in all joint ventures, you need to have alignment between the partners. And because we were only on the old engine and not on the new engine, and the other partners were on both the old and the new, we no longer had alignment. So we had to get out of the IAE. But the decision was much, much earlier than that. That was a consequence. So getting out of IAE was a consequence of the earlier decision. So that's how we've ended up. That's where we ended up in the position that we're in the narrow body market. If I look at the narrow body market, again, it's huge. You're all familiar with that. Significant growth. It's about 71% of the volume and about 50% of the value. So wide body, 50, narrow body, 50 approximately. Value, volume more in the narrow body. We're going to get back in this market, but it isn't an issue for today or tomorrow because I don't think anybody here would expect a new narrow body aircraft before the middle of the next decade at the earliest. But from my perspective, it's a great opportunity for us. It's a great future growth opportunity for us, because if I'm not in it really today, I'm in a little bit. Great opportunity in the future then for growth. And it also brings other things. Customer intimacy. If we're only talking about wide body, it's just part of it. If you're talking about the whole wide and narrow, you're much more intimate with your customer. It's a great volume market. Technology goes up and down from the wide to the large to the small, from the small to the large. It's a good place to be. Oh, and by the way, it's what we do. So why wouldn't we want to be in that market? But it's not a decision for today or tomorrow, but it's something that we're going to do. We've got to get back in that market. Medium speed, reciprocating engines. I've got a couple of slides and I'm going to skip through. We put them in the deck to try to help you understand a bit about this market, because I recognise that many people are less familiar with these markets than others. So I've got a few slides which I will really whiz through. Low speed, two-stroke engines, different technologies to high and medium speed, big, huge cathedral engines, mostly in the merchant vessels. High speed, this is the business Tognum that we bought, power systems. Much more wide range of applications, marine, land power, off-road vehicles. For power systems, about a third of our revenue there is marine related, about a third is off-road, and about a third relates to power generation. Good business, as I said earlier, we're going to take you over there next year, and we're going to give you a deep dive into that business. Medium speed. It's what we've done, quite small in medium speed. Land and sea, marine and land power. Common-ish technology to the high speed. Having Rolls-Royce Power Systems is really helping us in our medium speed capability. Provides power to all marine segments. Anyway, I've given you a list of some of the characteristics of those. Let me talk a little bit about the industry. A number of people have said, well, why would you want to be in this kind of business? Sort of, it hasn't grown, it's not doing anything, this part of the world. Certainly, it was growing, and now it hasn't, as a consequence, really, of the global financial crisis. If you stand back and look at it, the industry grows at around about GDP over a long period of time. It's not just me that thinks that. If you talk to other providers, they would say those are it. And there are a number of other drivers of it, but GDP being most significant. It's a pretty big market, $35 billion to 2023. So it's a growth market. The growth may have been a little more volatile recently than it was in the past. Why engines? Why engines? We, as I said, have got a terrific equipment systems base. We do a lot of other things very well, whether it's the electronics, the complex deck machinery, the propulsion systems, the vessel design. We've got a good portfolio, very good portfolio. We're relatively weak at engines. Engines, for many decisions in this industry, are the heart of the vessel. And rather like in narrow body, it drives a level of customer intimacy. Early customer engagement, you get access to other opportunities to pull in the other equipment, and so it helps the pull-through. The engine tends to be at the heart of the vessel. It helps the pull-through of the other equipment. So if you can be in that discussion with the operator, the vessel owner, or the shipyard early on, and the engine is the prime decision that they're making, if you've got the engine equipment to offer them, you can use that to help sell the other equipment. That's it in a nutshell. The engine also happens to be where most of the aftermarket lies, as you would expect. So if I look at our traditional marine business, so this is our traditional marine business rather than a MIPS business, or with, you know, taking out submarines, I've taken out power systems. If I look at our traditional marine business, that's how the revenue breaks down. Almost 90% is related to marine equipment, where we have a terrific portfolio. Medium speed engines is actually sort of our weaker part in our portfolio. So medium speed engines in terms of the marine sales is interesting to us because it completes the portfolio. And it's a powerful driver for the rest of the equipment. It's a virtuous circle. I can make it a lot more complicated than that, but that's it in a nutshell. Completes the circle, virtuous circle, helps drive pull through. And it's a growth market, and it's something that we understand and know, and with the help of the people in power systems, we are well placed in the medium speed reciprocating business. Interestingly, in high speed reciprocating business, in our power systems business, what we're finding, of course, as you would expect, is we're selling marine equipment off the back of their marine sales. So the pull-through is real. It does happen. Early days yet. Got lots more to do in that. But we are already doing that. So those are our priorities. Fix the basics, the four C's. Culture. Wide body, narrow body, medium speed. Reciprocating engines. As I said at the start, concentrate on what we're good at and where we can earn value. Concentrate on looking after the product through the life cycle of the product. Invest in technology. Build a portfolio of products that have common and complementary characteristics. Execute efficiently and effectively. And be in growth markets with barriers to entry. That's what we are doing. That's where we are. That's the strategy. And that's really my final slide. Strong position in growth markets, concentrate on what we do, significant opportunities. Now I'm going to hand over to Mark, who's going to talk about our capital allocation, our views of capital allocation, and guidance. Thanks very much.
Thank you, John, and good morning, everyone. So John has talked to you about our strategy, our business model, and our market opportunities. What I want to do in this session is just talk about how we link, how we think about strategy and opportunities to our internal decision-making processes and sort of financial discipline. We'll talk a little bit about our capital allocation drivers, and then finally, our financial or future financial guidance framework. So as John said, our strategy has evolved, and over the last decade, we've invested, we've acquired, we've disposed of things. But fundamentally, our DNA is the same. We're a high-technology, complex power systems and services company, and that informs everything that we do. Now, on the left there, you'll see the three lenses that we look through when we think about strategy: customer, innovation, and profitable growth that John has talked about. Basically, customer plus innovation equals profitable growth when we get it right, when we understand our customers, the right innovation. And when we don't understand our customers, of course, we don't always get it right, and that informs our decisions about why we may dispose of or get out of certain things. So where are we today, and as we look forward, what are we focused on in terms of delivering shareholder value? Well, there's six things up there on the right-hand side, and let me just go through each of them. It's important. Executing on our organic growth programs. Again, we see ourselves as a growth business first and foremost. We see great opportunities, and this is predominantly around our Trent programs at the moment. They're obviously absorbing a lot of time and effort as we ramp up and make sure we deliver our commitments to our customers. Huge order book giving us that great visibility. Exit non-core and underperforming businesses. Of course, we've been doing this steadily. You've seen more recently the sale of our energy business, but prior to that, some of our low-carbon businesses and our recent joint venture on the RTM 322. Closest to my heart, the CFO, of course, driving financial performance. The four Cs, and in particular two of those Cs, cost and cash, as you'd expect, as CFO, are dear to my heart, and things that we are relentlessly focused on. And of course, we're strongly focused on closing the margin gap with our competitors, as we have talked to you before. Integrating Rolls-Royce Power Systems, a big acquisition for us, formerly Tognum. I'm encouraged. We've been management control for about 18 months now. I'm encouraged with the process so far in terms of where we are in integration. But there'll be more to do when we become the 100% owners, and we see more opportunities coming from that. We've reorganized ourselves into two clear strategic pillars: a power systems company that takes itself to its markets through two main platforms: gas turbines and reciprocating engines. And again, John, I think, has talked at length to you on those. And finally, disciplined M&A. We've been a significant acquirer in the past and at certain times, and we've moved the company on. And we will continue to look at M&A. Doesn't always mean it has to be large M&A, product and technology bolt-ons, but it forms part of the makeup of who we are and ensuring that we stay ahead of the game, particularly around our technology and products. I put this chart up here because I just want you to really understand how the Rolls-Royce mindset works. This is how we look at things when we're trying to evaluate where we invest, which is the sort of strategic framework, which is on the left-hand side. And again, I think John has given us your insights into where we see the opportunities. And of course, in the middle there, technology, products, and route to market, where we see ourselves. And again, high technology, this is our lifeblood, this is where we invest. The barriers to entry that keep us where we are, it's important that we stay match fit. Looking at opportunities for products and where the growth markets are, and of course, ultimately, they manifest themselves in those two things at the bottom: either organic growth, R&D, and spending on CapEx, or M&A to acquire technology, products, or routes to market. Let me now focus a little bit on the right-hand side, which is sort of how we think about and decide about investing. This is our financial framework. And we look at that again through what I call sort of three main filters: growth metrics, capital efficiency, and financial strength. And I put up a few of the main sort of KPIs and metrics that we look at. And this gives us the discipline, as you'd expect, a lot of focus around the cost and cash side in driving financial performance, and again, how we focus on closing the margins with our competition. But both those sides need to be balanced with those three criteria in the middle. And they will drive different behaviours and different thought processes depending on whether it's strategic or financial in nature, short versus long term, and of course, growth versus profitability. And interesting, I've put those two up there because quite often when you're growing, it's quite difficult to grow profitably. Now, not saying you can't, but it's sometimes a trade-off that we need. But all of the time, what we're thinking about is how do we maximise long-term value creation for us and our shareholders. Importantly, whenever we look at any form of investment, the minimum requirement is that we have an IRR that exceeds our WACC. Of course, we'd expect it to be considerably higher than that. And WACC, I carry a number of about 9% around in my head post-tax. I mean, clearly there's an element of subjectivity around some of the assumptions, and we're all familiar that there's generally a range if I was to go out to the markets and ask what I thought or what you thought our WACC was. Now, underpinning our financial framework, there are really two key drivers: credit rating and capital allocation discipline and thought process, which I'm going to come on to in a minute. Now, the reason I say credit rating is it's not a negative constraint, but it's an important consideration for us in our business. You're familiar with us and the type of business that we are. It's important that we have a good credit rating. We're a long-cycle business, capital-intensive, sometimes decades to realise some of our investments. We enter long-term contracts with governments and customers, sometimes as long as 20 years. We commit to aircraft programs with people like Boeing and Airbus that will run for many, many years. We need to make sure they have the confidence in us that we will be around to fulfil our obligations and processes over that period. It provides access to long-term finance through the debt capital markets, which is far more in keeping with our investment cycles. But importantly, the reason I mention it, recognising this is predominantly about equity rather than debt today, is that the credit rating starts to define the architecture and capital structure that we can live within around the various ratios the rating agencies look at, and you're all familiar. Net debt to EBITDA, funds from operations, EBITDA, leverage, liquidity ratios, etc., etc. So where do we sit in this? We're very clear we want to maintain an investment grade rating. And we target a range between A- and A+. That's a generic range. Of course, the equivalent for Moody's would be A3 to A1. And similarly, so when we look between S&P, Moody's, and Fitch, that is the sort of thing that we're thinking about. Of course, we recognise it's not our gift to give. It's one we need to earn and convince our rating agencies of. But it is very focused on our agenda and how we look at things. Currently, we're A with S&P and A3 with Moody's. So let me now just turn to capital allocation. We think about capital allocation at two levels. At the group level, and those four things down the side that I'm going to come to talk about in a minute, and at the divisional level, which is once we've thought through the group level, how do we allocate capital within our businesses? How do they all compete for capital in terms of where we see opportunities? And it varies through the cycle and depending on what the dynamics of the markets are. So let me just start at the group level and go through. As I've said before, first and foremost, we see ourselves as a growth business. So when we look at our capital allocation, we look at it sequentially, starting at the top, which is what is most dear to our heart, which is investing in our own business, organic growth, R&D, the lifeblood of what we do. The reason there are high barriers to entry in this business is because of the technology and the superiority of that technology that keeps us where we are. But of course, the important part is, in order to stay where we are, we need to keep investing to stay safe, match fit, and stay ahead of the game. Obviously, when you do R&D, it generally generates CapEx, which is an enabler. And of course, that's a part that, again, moves through the cycle. So let me just talk a little bit about R&D. Currently around 4.9%. As John said, at best, it might ease as we grow over time. But we're not ashamed to say that is. It's a vital part of our business. As a going concern, we continue to invest heavily. But as revenues grow, we do see the opportunity for some easing, although in absolute terms we expect it to continue to grow. R&T takes a number of forms, research and technology, which is much more generic, R&D on new programs, product upgrades, as well as cost reduction. Of course, John mentioned to you the 600 engineers that we talk about, 400 on OE and 200 on the aftermarket. And again, this is another way in which we grind out costs, improve reliability. Very, very important to us. On the CapEx side, we typically run between about 3 and 5% through the cycle. We're currently around 5. And as we said, we're going to drive towards 4 as we go forward over the next 3 to 5 years. And again, when I think about CapEx and look back over what we've got, we've done a lot of growth for capacity requirements. We've underinvested historically in IT, and we've been catching up on that, and it's a very important enabler in our business. But a large part of it is around the maintenance of the estate, as I call it. And John referenced to the drive and opportunities that we see in rationalising our footprint. We've got a number of old factories that we're getting out of, a lot of work to bring down and sweat harder the footprint as we go forward, which will drive efficiencies and drive costs out. So we're very disciplined in our approach about how we look at both R&D and CapEx, much more dynamic and intelligent decision-making going on around scale and themes that we can bring together. And there's some really exciting things that we're doing there that we're looking into. Of course, whilst we might be a growth business, we understand it's important that we reward our shareholders. And as you know, we are committed to a progressive dividend policy in line with underlying growth. We've returned over $1.65 billion to shareholders over the last 5 years. Now, our C shares are maintained. I know it's a relatively complex dynamic. It's maintained predominantly for some tax advantages and obviously some optionality it provides to investors in terms of receiving a capital or income distribution return. And we plan to carry on with that. So, of course, as we go through investing in our business, creating a regular return to our shareholders, we also have opportunities elsewhere to invest where we see opportunities. And, of course, we have a disciplined approach to M&A, and this is wherever we are on the cycle, we think about this. So when I talk about M&A, let me just be clear. It can also mean partnerships. It can mean joint ventures. It can mean small acquisition or CapEx acquisitions, typically as I call them, or it can be larger ones. And it can be in relation to either technology, product, or routes to market. And that middle column there, the sort of areas of focus that you might expect us to look at, I don't think many of them will be a surprise to you, but they're just ongoing parts as we keep recognizing the need for technology and products or routes to market. But I want to focus a little bit more on the criteria side. As I said before, we define ourselves as a complex power systems and services company. So that defines where we have the strategic fit. We're not about diversification. It's all around power systems. We're relentless when we look at the synergies, that we can quantify them and commit to them, both on the cost and revenue side. And we have a number of targets that we look at. And, of course, there are additional ones to these, but these are the ones that we target. Return on invested capital to be greater than our WACC within 3 years. And obviously, as a minimum, that the IR would exceed WACC. Now, generally, we look at focus at longer term much more on IRR and WACC because they sort of compare each other. WACC is a bit more of a transient, whereas return on invested capital is sort of what you do in a given year. And, of course, we think about our integration capabilities. You know, how much have we got on our plate at any one time? Can we accommodate? Some deals are resource-intensive on the human capital side. Some can be more resource-intensive on the financial capital side, and we have to balance that. And, of course, we have to think about the sequencing of things that are going on because things change over time. Now, I've talked about the importance of having a strong and efficient balance sheet, and one of the reasons that we start to define ourselves through our rating is that's important for providing those confidences that I relayed to you earlier on. So that's the sort of key part for us. But obviously within that, we can see that when we have either surplus cash or cash that's come from a discrete source such as a sale, we will certainly think about returning capital to shareholders. And of course, that's exactly what we've done in what we announced this morning. But I don't want anyone out there to think that we've run out of ideas. It's about balance sheet efficiency and the fact that we've had some discrete proceeds from a sale that, as we currently sit here today, we put cash onto the balance sheet, that when I look at our organic investment opportunities, the human capital, we just have not got enough people at the moment to go and spend some of that. So again, we're committed to ensuring that we have a strong but efficient balance sheet. And what I would say is it's something that we review at the board regularly. So we've announced a 1 billion share buyback. We think about a number of things in terms of how we return capital to shareholders. We think about the makeup of our register, the type of shareholder, the level of our share price, the ability to defray dilution from any disposal, and of course some of the tax restructuring, tax structuring opportunities. So to summarise, CapEx 3-5 through the cycle, we're driving to 4% over the next 3 to 5 years. Net R&D, around 4.9% currently. They said you can expect it to ease as revenues grow over time slightly. We will continue with our progressive dividend policy in line with underlying growth. We'll focus on medium-term M&A and, again, some of the targets around that. And we've announced a 1 billion share buyback in relation to the sale of the energy proceeds. So that covers the capital allocation portion. So let's just turn to future guidance framework. Now, just to be clear, we are not giving any medium-term outlook guidance today. So what I'm going to talk about today is the framework and how, what we will give, how we will give it, and when we will give it going forward. So if you just look at this chart up here, I've put up in year, next year, and medium-term, looking at the next 3 to 5 years. The left-hand column you're all familiar with, it's what we currently give already. So the stuff we give at group and at the segment level, and a few of the other criteria around things like CapEx and R&D spend and charge and so forth. We provided for next year revenue and profit guidance. And as we look at the medium term, that is what we are going to be giving as we go forward. Of course, most of you are familiar with that when we talk about guidance, we've typically in the past used words like modest, strong, good, etc. We're going to go away from that and move into percentage ranges or absolute ranges or numbers, and they're listed up there for you. So that's how we're going to give it. And this is when we will give it. So obviously in the in-year, we'll provide it regularly at the prelims and interims and at the IMSs. In relation to the following year, we will give you that at the November IMS. Normally, I'm going to come back to say something in a moment, but just follow my train of thought for a second. Annual budget cycle normally finishes around the end of October, early November, so in time for the November IMS, we'll give you an update on the following year. And ditto when we've gone through our annual 10-year planning cycle, which typically ends around the end of September, October time, we will provide you with the medium-term outlook, which will be our sort of best view at the time that we will update annually. Now, in relation to the medium-term outlook, this time round, when we get to our October day, which I think is the 21st of October in Norway, if we're ready then, which we should be, we will provide that to you in October, but normally it will be the November IMS. So, to summarise, we are clear on our strategy, a complex power systems and services company. We're clear on our priorities going forward. We have a disciplined approach to capital allocation. I think you've seen some of that in action in what we announced this morning. I'm going to give more guidance going forward. Now, I guess you've heard John and I talk for probably about an hour and 10 minutes. We're probably all gasping for a cup of coffee. So we're going to have a 20-minute coffee break now. And after that, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about Total Care. Tony is going to talk about the economics and logic and rationale and why we like Total Care. And I've got the really interesting bit of doing the accounting on Total Care. So make sure you have plenty of coffee, and we'll see you in about 20 minutes. Thank you.
Okay, well, welcome back, everybody, and nice to see some familiar faces again. And thank you, Mark, for teeing it up so beautifully at the move into the coffee break on Total Care. So John's spoken very much about our strategic priorities and how we see the evolution of the company, evolution, not revolution, over the long term. And Mark's talked about how we decide and think about capital allocation and the disciplined processes that we apply right the way across the business. But this morning I'm going to talk about Total Care. I know certainly I spoke to some of you in Paris last year about the aerospace business. I'm going to really try and unpick for you in more detail than I think we've shared before the economics and the strategy behind Total Care. And then I'm going to be followed by Mark, who's going to do the really interesting bit on unpicking and clarifying some of the accounting. In direct response to some of the questions that many of you have raised over recent months. So what is it that we're trying to do with Total Care? Well, it's very much about trying to maximise the value that we create for customers, and you'll see that in terms of how Total Care's evolved, the market has voted very positively on that, but also how it works for us as a business and how it works for you as shareholders in terms of creating and releasing the value, the embedded value that we get from that growing installed base of products that John spent quite a bit of time on this morning explaining how we see that evolving. And this very much underpins our confidence in how we see earnings and ultimately cash flow coming out of the business from the services business model that we've been working at for a large number of years now. So I'd like to start by going right back to the overall group and then working, as I've said, specifically into the Total Care piece of it. So we are, as you've heard a few times this morning, a high-technology, complex power systems and services company. And we have products that have very long in-service lives in all of the divisions in which we operate. They're measured in decades rather than in years. And we have very strong positions in all of those products and the growing markets in which they're positioned. And the company is being built around two very strong but connected pillars. And we allocate capital, obviously, to both technology and to develop products, and then we build the services opportunity on the back of those products as we build an installed base around the world. And that's true in every one of the markets that you see up there on the slide. And then we support those customers and those products through life in terms of the both the opportunity and the commitment that we make when we put products out there in the market. And that can be done through either long-term service agreements, of which Total Care is clearly a very familiar and a very well-known brand within the market, but equally in aerospace, mission care, corporate care for the military and the corporate and business aircraft sectors, also very well known and very successful. But equally, it's not just about long-term service agreements. We equally have a very important business, and for some customers, the time and material model still works and generates significant value. And half of the group's revenue, and a very strong contribution to both earnings and cash, came from our services business model and our services sales in 2013, when the slide shows some of the numbers there. So my focus today is going to be on aerospace, and it's going to be on Total Care. And 90% of our Trent fleet is now covered by Total Care long-term service agreement style contracts. And that very much speaks to the value that exists for customers from the way in which we package that service offering for them. But also, I think, as John mentioned early on this morning, the opportunity that the group has from what we know about doing this to start to build further on some of that opportunity in Laurie's business on marine and industrial power, building capability and a similar approach to that business model. And very telling and appropriate that we've just gained our first opportunity on a marine vessel on a Total Care style construct. So LTSAs already represent about 45% of the total services revenue across the group, so becoming an increasingly important part of services. So just to start with a very basic look at just how significant services is for a typical gas turbine now through life. And at constant economics, the services revenue annuity stream is worth more than four times the OE net selling price. That's a fairly conservative view relative to other numbers you may see out there in the market, but a very significant multiple, obviously, of the benefit of getting an installed product out there in service. We invest, obviously, prior to that for between 5 and 7 years to, on the initial program, creating the product. We invest about £1 billion of R&D every time we launch a new product and about £500 million of CapEx for a complete new engine and setting up the infrastructure and the supply chains to deliver them. And entry into service occurs around about 7 years after the launch of the program. And those products then are out there in service around the world for some 20 years or more. And it's interesting, if you were just to compare where we sit at the moment with the various engine programs, we literally have the Trent XWB on the A350 right at the left-hand end of the chart in front of you there, just about to enter service at the end of this year. Set fair and very good progress so far on that program. The Trent 700, you know, 1995 EIS, so already some 20 years into its life, but still selling well. And a big part of our delivery order board this year and into next. And then the RB211s, very much, you know, if you take the 535 on the Boeing 757, 1983, is already some 30 years into its service life, and those aircraft will continue to fly for quite some time yet, as you've seen on some of the earlier slides today. And first-tier operators are typically contracting for between 10 and 15 years, one of the questions I was asked in the coffee break. But then there's always a second-tier opportunity, and we're typically contracting for between 5 and 7 years for the second-tier operator of those aircraft. And really, just to try and put in perspective the value that both Total Care and Time and Material Solutions create. So we offer Total Care packages on a full-term basis. We also, for the full life of the engine, we also offer them on a term basis. And as you get towards the end of the anticipated life of the platform, we start to look at tailored solutions with some of the airlines that are operating older assets. And that's very true of the approach that we're taking and how we're keeping flying and keeping those products competitive on some of the older RB211 powered aircraft that are out there. But both Total Care and Time and Material and tailored solutions are important to us. In terms of that relationship with the airlines of keeping efficient and profitable aircraft flying for them around the world. But what's important here is that we have defined terms in our OE contracts under which Rolls-Royce sells and the operator buys spare parts, either from Rolls-Royce or from a Rolls-Royce approved vendor. And that's irrespective of whether the contracting terms are Total Care or the time and material support model that you see there. So this is the value creation. This is the embedded value story. That whilst the installed base will grow by around 50% over the next decade, and the direction of travel is clear, despite, you know, the sort of perturbations that can happen on any individual program, that by 2023, the install base is 50% bigger. But behind that, Rolls-Royce sees a doubling of thrust in the same period. And that really is the engine room of growth for us in terms of how the Trent engine success, the light blue in the middle of that slide, is far more than offsetting the reduction in the older RB211 fleets. And obviously, the thrust very much driving that opportunity. And there's confidence behind that chart, underpinned by the £60 billion order book that we have in aerospace, civil aerospace, of which some £30 billion is related to the Trent XWB. And the speed at which this grows, the cadence is changing in terms of how we're ramping up production. So it's taken us 18 years in the company to deliver the first 2,000 Trent engines. We'll deliver the next 2,000 over the next 5 years. The factories are largely in place. We've made significant strides, significant investments around the world in Singapore, in the United Kingdom, in Crosspoint in North America. But we will be continuing to go through the process of transitioning from older facilities to fully load the new facilities as we move work through into new processes, and also to accommodate with the growth, obviously, that's coming through. So there will be a process of investment and upgrading that continues over the next 2 or 3 years as we work our way up to peak capacity. But this is the largest expansion in the wide-body aircraft fleet of the world in history, and obviously that's a very big part of the Rolls-Royce civil aerospace story. So thrust is a very good proxy for services revenue, and of our order book, we only take about, there's only 29% of the total order book because it was represented by civil services, because we only take 7 years, a fairly modest portion, despite those contracts being between 10 and 15 years, typically, when we contract them. And the RB211, interesting statistic, that it's 20% of the installed base in 2013, but only 13% of the thrust. And that's largely because the older aircraft are starting to be used less or being used on freighter operations. But the light blue Trent fleet, very much the installed base is driving thrust, and the thrust is a very good proxy for us. So a lot of what Mark and I are going to focus on will be about the large engine business and what sits behind this. But I'd like to start by just reflecting on the fact that services for Rolls-Royce and supporting our large and growing installed base is nothing new. This is a world-leading capability that we've spent the last 20 years investing in. I've been with the company for some 15 years in various divisions, and this has been a consistent, enduring theme of how we position ourselves to take the services opportunity that's represented by our installed base. It's taken 20 years to develop. It's very hard to replicate, and we're uniquely positioned, I would argue, as the original equipment designer and manufacturer of these products to support them. And we see services on what I describe as a four-center model. So the big piece of the activity where most of our people and cost is based is in our service delivery centers, the overhaul centers that are supporting these products around the world, some 8,000 people, Rolls-Royce or joint venture employees. And in addition to that, we have independent shops, licensed shops around the world, also supporting our products. So that's where the real work gets done of overhauling and repairing engines. We have operations centers, three of them around the world, in the United States, United Kingdom, and Germany, that are monitoring the fleet. That's where the engine health monitoring and the management of very large volumes of data, some 22 million engine health monitoring reports that we're dealing with every year, and around 5,000 overhauls that are being supported in the overhaul bases as those engines are pulled off wing. We also have data centers, something we've been focusing on a lot for the last 3 years or so, having one version of the truth where all of the data associated with our products, the configurations, the data that we're extracting every day from products and services collected, which is all necessary to optimize both the performance of the product but also the cost base that we require to support it. And then we have the business centers, and that's where a lot of the capability and some of the things Mark's going to talk about happens, where we manage the contracts and the very detailed work that goes on that sits behind each and every one of these total care contracts, and a very large and dispersed number of line maintenance and on-wing care activities, the very small dots, as you'd expect, at all of the major air hubs and airports around the world. So it's a scalable infrastructure, it's a very significant capability, and it's a scalable business model to address the growth that I showed you on the previous chart with the growing installed thrust. And this chart is my best attempt to try and just get a layer underneath what we're actually doing in services and doing in Rolls-Royce. So there are 3 points at which we get a very deep and detailed understanding of the products that we have in service around the world. And it's a unique and unparalleled piece of capability that supports those products through life. So the design information that we collate for the 18,000 components or so that go into every one of the Trent engines and all of the detailed design data and performance data that we derive from owning and developing the intellectual property behind the design. The validation processes, whether through testing engines on wing, through test aircraft, 4 A350 test aircraft flying around the world today, test bed engines running in many continents as we validate the product, but increasingly so using supercomputers to actually model the performance of the product, reliably using computers and validating models at lower costs. A very big part of how we create data and the knowledge of that validation process for the product. And then the data that we collect every day from engines in service and literally building terabytes of data as we extract the information from the engine health monitoring and engine control systems. So if we look at this from the lens of the airline in terms of where does the conversation start on how will I support the engine on the airframe that I've selected. And these are some of the typical operating costs for a power plant in service. And an airline has to choose how to manage the list of items that you see on the left-hand side there. And you clearly need to invest to maintain both the performance and also the availability and reliability of these engines through service. And it's a balance of risk, of capability in terms of just how much infrastructure and capability the airline has, and ultimately cost and cost efficiency. And total care has become the model of choice for customers. And that's really because it underpins, it transfers risk to Rolls-Royce because we guarantee the availability of the aircraft, and we also have very predictable costs for the airline through a dollar per hour revenue stream coming to Rolls-Royce. From them. And Rolls-Royce is taking and is best placed to manage the risk through a focus on the reliability and the maintenance cost footprint as we look at these engines on a fleet basis worldwide. So what is in a total care contract? I don't think we've perhaps shared this level of detail before. So the core total care offering, all contracts have the same foundation for core services. So the engine overhaul costs, the reliability improvements that we are always working through and seeking to insert in the in-service fleet. Engine health monitoring, if you have a total care package, you're getting both trend monitoring and a very proactive approach to life management and the logistics issues that an airline has to manage to keep aircraft available whilst aircraft are going through the hangar through for maintenance. We work and provide a fleet optimization and logistics service, the fleet management part of the package. And we provide a through-life warranty. When you sign with Rolls-Royce for 10 to 15 years, that is a through-life warranty on that product, as opposed to the normal warranties you'd get in a time and material world, which actually lapse quite quickly, reverting back to, obviously, those cost risks being borne by the airline. So it is absolutely a lower risk package for the airline with very predictable costs. And we support full service carriers right through to low cost airlines. But there's still an option for those airlines that have large maintenance businesses, the Lufthansa's, the Singapore Airlines, to participate in the maintenance activity, the labour associated with the overhaul. But total care is one unified price of contract. And beyond the items that you see with a tick in the core packages, there are many upsell opportunities as well. Things like life-limited parts or even spare engine support services that we can sell as a time and material package. The operator, the airline still needs them, or we can incorporate those within a dollar per hour rate. And increasingly, we're seeing some of those items transition to within the total care package. I think the reason for showing you that is that we have a very good track record at being able to manage the risk, deliver on those cost assumptions, and as the fleet matures and our portfolio matures, we get better at this every time. And with 20 years' experience now on fleets like the Trent 700, this is really the heart of the capability and the confidence we have in being able to manage and get it right on our cost assumptions. So very simply, looking at the revenue and the cost side of the equation, what underpins our confidence in revenue? Well, global RPK, revenue passenger kilometres, the global fleet is being pushed at about 4.5% increase in revenue passenger kilometres, and every airline around the world is working very hard on their load factors and their aircraft utilisation. So that's the main underpinning. An engine, typically, around about 4,000 hours per year that we would expect to see on a wide-bodied aircraft. And we have arrangements and contractual thresholds in there for minimum utilisation, so quite a few protections around that. And should those change, or should the way in which the operator, the airline, uses the aircraft change, the route structures, the stage lengths, the D rate in terms of the operations they're using it on, then it's relatively easy and straightforward conversation for us to adjust the pricing model around that. The rate per hour is very much about the harshness of the model and a very precise pricing based on a unique knowledge of the usage impact on an engine's life. I mean, that again is a unique piece of our intellectual property as to the wear mechanisms and how those engines perform in service. And the rate is inherently related to our understanding, obviously, of cost. And probably the simplest way you can think about cost is the most powerful determinant of cost in a service and support contract under total care is time on wing. It is extending that time on wing, which delays the maintenance event and the cost to do the overhaul. And I'll come back to this later from an engineering focus on improving this. But otherwise, cost is well aligned with our pricing approach and is very much based on usage. And the cost per shop visit, we determine the work scope for every one of those engines that comes into the overhaul shop, what the work is that actually has to be done, with a very close focus on the reuse of parts, serviceable used parts, on repair, and we invest quite heavily in repair technology. It's an important part of driving cost out, and also the replacement policy, ultimately, which is an OE part being fitted into an engine. And from a labour perspective, that's the productivity drive within our overhaul shops or the joint venture relationships around the world. So I'd like to go one level lower in terms of, so what's behind time on wing, and what really gives us and hopefully you the confidence of what we know here. So every engine has many parts in it, but about 15 to 20 of those parts, the critical life-limited parts, are mapped onto this chart. This shows the probability of the engine being removed as a result of that part reaching its life limit versus the time on wing. And what we're trying to do is obviously move these red lines to the right-hand side here, because it's the statistical probability distribution of the life characteristics of each of those critical parts. And this drives the decision ultimately on when to remove the engine for overhaul, and obviously therefore the point at which time on wing is considered. And when you take all of these components in aggregate, you end up with a probabilistic line, combining those component characteristics to determine the whole engine life. And it's by improving those individual component lives, changing the angle of those red lines that you saw on the first chart there, through experience in service, through upgrades, through improvements that we can insert into the fleet, that really has given us a very powerful point of leverage in extending time on wing. And it's the unique and the deep design knowledge and in-service experience that we have that enables us to do this. And it's not just theory. Doubling the time on wing on engines like the Trent 700 and Trent 800 since they entered service is real, as well as upgrading and improving the fuel burn and the overall reliability of those products in the same period. And the Trent 700 is a very good example to pick. With some 92% of the engines that we deliver from new only being removed from wing at the point at which we expect it to be removed as a result of reaching a life-limited part overhaul condition. So it's a very predictable and planned approach to maintenance that enables us to have the confidence in the total care commitment that we're making for customers. It benefits the airline, and it obviously has a big benefit to us in terms of the cost and the competitiveness. And the cost focus is broader than just time on wing. Improving inspection criteria, some £11 million on the top example there on the Trent 700 turbine inspection criteria being saved as a result of being able to reinstall a part on some 12,000 refurbishments that we see over the next few years. And obviously the accounting opportunity and the cost opportunity from having the confidence to do that. On engine health monitoring, we started working in early 2000 with a biotech company looking at algorithms to try and predict the onset of a cardiac arrest in a cardiac patient by monitoring various of the vital signs on a human. We bought the industrial rights to some of those algorithms and that technology in 2009, and the very latest versions of the Trent XWB and the Trent 1000 have those algorithms within the control systems that gives us an even better capability to predict and avoid in-service disruption and the expensive in-service events for an unplanned removal. An engine removal incident is somewhere between half and $1 million every time it happens. And a very significant one on the bottom from repair technology. That's a £200,000 roughly component, a bearing housing on one of our engines. We found a mechanism, invested some £14 million in a repair technique. It's a big investment in repair technology to find a way to repair that unique component. It delivered a saving of some £56 million by avoiding the need to replace that component at shop visit on some 350 engine overhauls. So it's real and it's a big focus, and John mentioned at the start, 400 engineers on original equipment cost reduction, 200 on services. This is the power of some of the opportunities we identify to take cost out of our service package lines. So I hope that's given you a clearer view of both the embedded value within our business model, but also how we focus on continuing to reliably deliver this for both customers and for you as investors. And that's how we look at and how we create value, the economics of the model, the most important part of the business model for me. And it now just leaves me with the chance to pass over to Mark to talk about the... what he sold as the most interesting part of this in terms of the accounting bit. So, Mark, over to you.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Tony. I can tell the excitement is mounting. So, this is the pointy head accounting piece that I'm going to try and make simple. So I'm going to talk about three things here, and we're going to build up as we go along. I'm going to talk about the commercial arrangements and how the accounting principles relate to them. I'm going to talk about the accounting mechanics, and we're going to build up slowly. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the portfolio dynamics as we start overlaying various programs and where we are in the cycle. So here goes. I think maybe before we start, it's just important to remind ourselves of the commercial arrangements that we have in this business. So we deal with three types of customer. Airlines, that would include freighter operators and VIP aircraft for high net worth individuals. Lessors you're familiar with, they can be bank style lessors or financial lessors or operating lessors such as ILFC, AirCap, CIT, etc. And, of course, airframers such as Boeing, Airbus, Embraer, and so forth. On the aftermarket side, there are two types of contract. The first one you're all very familiar with, time and materials, or T&M as it's often referred to in the trade. And the second one, total care, which is what we're going to spend our time on, and particularly around the accounting. Let me just talk a little bit about those two just for a second, because it's quite important. And the time and materials, the airline takes the risk of time on wing and the risk of the shop visits and doing the work scopes, putting them to shops, whether it's their own or others. Under total care, there is a risk transfer. We take those risks and we provide them with a service. And arguably, we are the logical risk taker on the grounds that we build the engines, we have more data and information than anybody else, we have the scale of economies around us, the spare engines, the networks to sweat our assets properly and share some of those benefits with our customers to incentivize them to go down the total care path. And again, as Tony talked about, very important to understand, because this is just basic maths. Our business model is a very simple one, fundamentally. As you grow your install base, you drive an annuity, which runs for about 25, 30, 40 years, depending on the type of product that we're talking about. Tony made it very clear to you that generally we generate about 20% of our revenue on the OE and about 80% on the aftermarket. We make much better margins in the aftermarket, as you're all familiar with. Now, the reason I lay this out is important because this is going to drive the accounting, the different types of arrangements. And importantly, only the airline enters into either T&M or total care. Lessors and airframers do not. They may be involved in us selling engines to them, but they don't operate them. Okay, let's start with the accounting principles. So when we start thinking about the accounting, we go through a flow diagram process, basically, of asking ourselves some basic questions. And I'm going to build this flow chart up. So the first question we ask is, when a new piece of engine business is done, so when we've sold some new engines to someone, the question we ask ourselves is there a total care contract accompanying it? If the answer is no, that can be for any of those customer cases, then we know that the aftermarket, by default, is time and materials. On the right, you're seeing an orange box that says contractual aftermarket rights. I'm just going to explain this. Those of you who are the more pointy heads who follow this stuff, you normally would see that as a recoverable engine cost. You're aware we've been having discussions with the FRC about our accounting, which they conclude that our accounting is correct in terms of how we look for it. But they made a good suggestion to us, which was, we don't understand why you call it a recoverable engine cost, because ultimately it's a contractual aftermarket right, which is what allows you to create the intangible asset. And we agreed with them. They're right. It's a much better explanation because when we sell an engine, there is a requirement for the airlines to buy spare parts from us to keep their warranties and guarantees in place. Now, I'm going to explain a little bit more about that later, so just park that one for a moment. But contractual aftermarket right exists to the extent there is a loss on the sale of original equipment. Of course, we don't always lose money when we sell original equipment, but when we do, we create something called an aftermarket right, formerly known as a recoverable engine cost. Next step. So if there is a total care agreement, the next question we ask ourselves is it negotiated with the same party? Now, let me take a simple example. Lessor buys an aircraft. He leases it to an airline. So he's entered into a deal with us to determine the commercial terms of the original equipment, but the airline is going to negotiate with us the total care contract. So we have two contracts, a total care contract with an airline, original piece of equipment with a lessor. If he's taken a total care contract, we now have two pieces. On the aftermarket, we call it an unlinked total care contract. Just bear with me, I'm going to build these all up. Just remember the boxes. Unlinked total care, and again, if there's any loss on the OE, we generate an aftermarket right. Okay. So, if it is negotiated with the same party, we have to go down the next level of filter, which is, was it negotiated at the same time? So it is quite possible for an airline to buy its aircraft and decide that it's not going to make a decision about whether it goes T&M or total care. If 1 year into the contract it decides that it wants to go total care because it actually likes what it sees, you've got two contracts that were effectively entered into at a different time. So again, we treat them as unlinked because they were not done at the same time, hence the unlinking. And again, if there is a loss on the OE, we've got an aftermarket right. And finally, the case where we have a total air care agreement, it's with the same airline, and it was done at the same time. Okay? So Airline X comes and says, I want to buy some aircraft, and at the same time I want to enter into a 15-year total care agreement with you, Rolls-Royce. We refer to that as a linked contract, and the ones that most of you are familiar with. Okay, so those three things important. Contractual aftermarket rights, formerly known as recoverable engine costs. Unlinked contracts, when we've either got different counterparties or not negotiated at the same time. Linked contract, same counterparty, negotiated, same time. So far, so good. Okay. I'm going to keep diving. Contractual aftermarket rights. Very, very simple example. It's illustrative. I don't want you to think for a second that we're always losing money on OE, but this is an example where we do, so it might be launch phasing, where learner curve is high and launch conditions and so forth. In this simple example, we have a unit cost of a Phantom engine that costs us $5 million. The customer has a net selling price of $4 million, and so we make a $1 million loss in this example. This is where the accounting starts to come in now. Under IAS 38, something referred to as intangible assets, what this says is, look, businesses aren't generally in the businesses for giving away their products below their cost. You must be doing it for a reason. You think you're going to make some money somewhere else. Correct. We are. So what they look at it and they say, well, can you value it? And the answer is, yes, we can value it to a certain extent, but we can't value it with a high degree of accuracy because under something like T&M, we do not know exactly the flying patterns that they're going to operate. But what we do know is it is definitely in excess of the size of the loss on an NPV basis. So when you're sure it's bigger than the loss, but not sure exactly that you can value it down to the level of a dollar, we are only allowed to take the loss element. So effectively, we sell it at cost, effectively, is how we'd account for it. We create an intangible asset on the balance sheet. In this case, it would be $1 million, and we amortize it over 15 years. So that's what we do with customer aftermarket rights where there are OE losses. Okay. Unlinked total care. Now, let's remind ourselves, unlinked total care, it's different counterparties or negotiated at different times. We can't link them under IAS 11, which is all about construction-style accounting, because they fail the test of not being negotiated together. Clearly, two independent parties can't be one, and if you're doing it at different times, you can't negotiate it at the same time. And again, we have an unlinked total care contract, which is governed by revenue recognition rules under IAS 18, and there, the revenue and the costs are going to be recognized in line with flying hours. Okay? We've talked about the aftermarket right. So let's just do an example, an unlinked, to make sure we're all clear. So in this simple example, it's a single engine. It's got a 10-year contract, 10-year life, 10-year length. It flies a 4,000 hours a year, sort of numbers that Tony was talking about, just to put it into perspective. So 40,000 hours in total, $10 million of revenue over the 10 years, and that's driven by, in our simple example, an engine flying hour rate of $250. So I get the laser to work here for a second. $250. We've assumed a cost rate of $150 in this, and therefore a margin of 100 or 40% in this particular example. So what happens at 1 year on? So we started the contract, we've got a 10-year contract, he's running 4,000 hours a year. At the end of 1 year, he's done a year, he's done 4,000 hours. 4,000 times 250 gives you 1 million. You can do the maths for the rest, and we end up with our 0.4 margin based on the million of revenue that we've got. Okay? Now, just to be clear, if he only flew 3,000 hours, we actually book the actual hours they've flown. But remember, he's entered into a contract to say he's going to fly 4,000. If he puts that right the following year, nothing really changes. But to the extent he doesn't, we have to make adjustments, which I'll talk about in a moment. But let's assume that he's doing what he says for the moment. Okay, so this is the graph that unfolds for a single engine when we look at an unlinked. So, again, laser time. We start at zero. So there's three curves here. Cash revenue, cash costs, and the margin. So let's just take them each in turn. Let's start with the costs. On unlinked, remember we're just talking about an aftermarket contract. We start off on the cost side. There are no costs at day one. Okay? On the cost side, we haven't built an engine, we've done nothing. We haven't turned any spanners, nothing's happened. So we don't do a lot. In this simple example, we assume we do nothing. In reality, we do small minor checks. But the big things happen around 4 or 5 years, which is the first overhaul and then a second overhaul around 8 or 9 years. And these things can be quite lumpy, anywhere between about $3 and $5 million on a big engine. The revenue line, nice and simple, straight line. He's flying 250, he's flying 4,000 hours a year, 250. It's just a straight line keeps going up. And of course, we account for the margin, which is an output of the cost and revenue recognition. 40% in this case just runs along here. So let's just move to the next graph. Now, this may be a bit of a surprise to some of you because you normally always think about debtors and TCAs. When we do an unlinked TCA deal, generally we never have a debtor. You can do down here in the sort of smaller parts, but let me just... Yeah. Now, what have we got on this list? We've got here the net cash position, the black line, and the margin, which is just transferred from the other graph. We build up a creditor position because what we're doing is we're collecting cash every month, that 250 times the hours flown each month. We're not turning any spanners until we get to about year 4 or 5. We do a big overhaul. And in this case, obviously, we generate a small debtor position. Again, just remember, creditor and debtor, we talk about it, is just whether profit is ahead of cash or vice versa. And of course, they end up together mathematically at the end. Okay. It was unlinked, so we've done aftermarket rights, unlinked, and now here we go into linked. So let's just remind ourselves, linked, negotiated at the same time, has to be with the airline, he's bought the OE, and he's doing the aftermarket. Definition around linked is all driven by IAS 11, construction contracts. And there are three criteria that you have to satisfy that are written up there. Negotiated as a single package, closely interrelated, contracts performed concurrently. That's the language that we look through. Okay, let's go on for an example in this one. So, this is the starting point before we start overlaying the accounting dynamics of margin adjustment. So, in the linked total care, we start with the OE on the left. So, in this simple example, again, single engine example, assume a list price of 10, we take off some concessions, the discount, net selling price of 4 in this example, assumed a cost of 5, and negative OE of minus 1 in this example. Total care, 10-year contract, generate 8 million of revenue. No concessions here, but obviously we have our costs, which you've assumed 4, and again you can do the maths. A 25% blended margin in this example. Of course, the previous one was 40, just an illustrative purpose, here 25. Now, under the rules of linked accounting, we treat everything as one. And therefore, we have to look at smoothing the margins. And this is what happens. You can see that obviously we're making no margin on the OE or loss on the OE, and we're making a good margin on the aftermarket. And what we do is we balance the two. Now, we don't do it on the cost side, because if you think about it, on the cost side, it is actual cost on the OE. That's our unit cost. We know that, and an estimate, our best estimate on the aftermarket. Now, hopefully you can trust me that I've done the maths right here, but what I've done is just even them up to get you to 25%. And as you can see, the output here is obviously we still have the physical cash loss of 1 million, but we've created a profit of 1.7, so we've now got
profit ahead of cash of 2.7, which is our friend the debtor, which we'll talk about. And, of course, the mass corresponding must create a corresponding creditor on the other side to create as flat at the end. So, again, simple example, but just to get the point across on how it works. So, again, let's just take some lines. So you remember on the unlinked one, we started at zero in both cases. In this one, we don't. So if I just take the cash cost line, the reason it starts off below zero is, of course, it's just our unit cost of the engines. This is just purely the cost side. We've incurred cost in building the engines. It's a linked contract. Don't really turn any spanners until we get to about here, and then the same thing happens again. And this is the net revenue we've seen at the front, that 4 million that we talked about. And this is the margin take. So again, we're recognising revenue and costs in line with flying hours. And this example is a 25% margin realisation. So, our friend, the debtor. As you can see here, I've just transferred the margin 25% line, straight line. And then this is the net cash position. And of course, what you're seeing here is the unit cost of the engines, followed by some of the cash we've got from the front end. And then obviously as time goes up, we're generating cash every month, we're invoicing for cash, we do some work in the overhauls, and you get this sawtooth and back where we started. So that is linked. Okay, so those are single engine examples. Now, in the simple world we've just gone through, we have assumed that the assumptions we made at day one are right through the entire 10-year period. I wish that was always the case because it would make our life a lot easier. So let's just think about something. We've entered into a contract for 10 years where an airline has told us they're going to do X flying hours, Y stage length, and various other criteria that will affect both the cost and what we charge as the revenue flying hour. We've made assumptions about cost and reliability going forward on our engine programs. Where we have a mature program, we have a lot more empirical data to support it. Where we have a new program, we have algorithms and architecture that tell us how we think it should behave. And then, of course, we've got the performance risk, as I'll call it, around our customers actually doing their part of the bargain over the next 10 years. So what can change when we talk about these things? Let's talk about each one. So the revenue forecast. The revenue forecast can only change by the customer. If you tell us he's doing 4,000 hours and only does three, that will adjust the revenue forecast. Obviously, whenever you change the revenue forecast, it creates a corresponding change in the cost forecast, because clearly if you burn less hours, you'll do less on the engine, and therefore it'll take longer in terms of time period for you to have your overhaul. If we look at the cost and reliability forecast, this is down to us. We look at our programs, we look at what they're doing, and decide a best estimate of what we think is happening. Now, importantly, we factor a number of things in when we look over a 10-year period. Our best estimate of what it is, that makes some assumptions about either improvements we're going to bake in from engineering or experiences that we're getting through. We include something called an estimation risk at the early point of any program. And that is that whilst we've given our best estimate, we put an element of cautiousness over it, which sort of says we might not be exactly right. And that unwinds over time, all other things being equal. Of course, we could go 2 years into the contract and actually find that our experience is getting better or worse, and then we make an adjustment. That's called estimation risk. I'm going to come on a little bit more on those in a minute. Asset recoverability. This is about performance of the contract. In very simple terms, if I put it into banking speak, when you look at a AAA counterparty versus a CCC counterparty, generally you either give a bigger NPV up front if you're looking to discount cash flows or whatever it is, or sign less risk, or you create more of a reserve for a riskier counterparty. We do not take as much margin on a higher risk transaction as on a lower risk transaction. It's driven predominantly around the counterparty risk and the fleet fit, importantly, which is how essential are the aircraft that we are providing to the fleet. Is it not the feeder traffic, but the mainstream traffic or whatever? So that creates a valuation allowance. And again, that unwinds over time. Again, counterparty risk tends to reduce as time decreases. And of course, that unwinds as well over time. Just to put this into perspective, if I talk on costs and our assumptions, what has our experience been? If I look back on average, if I look at in-year civil profits, the impact of adjustments for cost have been around plus or minus 4% on in-year civil profits. A 1% change on our portfolio in cost assumptions has an in-year impact of about £30 million. Now, let me just come on to the next slide. Because there's some important points just to recognise here. The governance around this. Every balance sheet date, before every balance sheet date, we do a process review of every contract we have, and we update the revenue and cost forecasts. If there are some changes, we revise the margin, because the margin is an output of those two, and obviously the debtor and creditor are an output of the margin versus the cash. If there is a change, it's going to impact the current year. It's also going to impact the prior years, because in very simple terms, if I've been taking 12% for the first 3 years, and all of a sudden I should be taking 13% through life, I need to catch up 1% on the previous 3 years. Now, under the rules, we do not restate our accounts. We make an in-year adjustment, which we refer to as a true-up or a catch-up. So the in-year impact can have a multiple impact depending on how mature your portfolio is. At the moment, like I said, it's about £30 million for 1% move. And that includes the in-year adjustment and the prior year and in-year adjustment. And obviously, if you make a change, it will have your future margin impact, but that's a sort of non-balance sheet item at that stage. Okay, summary. So let's just remind ourselves. Unlinked total care, we recognise revenue and accrue costs in line with flying hours. The same applies for linked contracts, but we equalise the margin, again, under the construction contract of IAS 11. We factor in what we call estimation risk and valuation allowance, and of course what that does is it basically suppresses the margin at the front end. It's an element of cautiousness, prudence, if you were. Relevant standards we've talked about here are IAS 18, revenue recognition, IAS 38, intangible assets, and IAS 11, construction contracts. We've renamed RECs to contractual aftermarket rights, and we've agreed our accounting treatment with the FRC. So this was single engines. I'm going to start making it a little bit more complicated now. So that was a single engine. I think it was quite easy to show the picture. Now, as you know, we deliver many engines over many years. The ramp-up rates vary. The volumes of the programs can vary. We have 8 programs in our civil large engine business just at the moment. But I'm just going to talk about one program at the moment. This is a generic program. It could be something like the Trent 800. But just to give you an example of what happens. So all I've done here is I've taken the profit take and I've assigned them, and again we're talking about a linked contract, so equal margin now, between the OE piece, which is the red dotted line, the aftermarket profit, and then I've added the two together with the green line here. So as you can see, what you'd expect, profit is taken, it's been equaled out, and as deliveries eventually fall away to nothing down here, and of course the aftermarket just keeps growing, because of course the engines are installed, and they keep driving for their useful life. That is a typical profile of what we see in terms of profit. So what I've done is I've taken the combined line, that green line that we had there, which is this one here, and then compared that with the net cash line. And again, with a linked contract, as we all know, we have a rising debtor position at the middle of, at the beginning of a program, point where we get peak net debtor, and then debtor is decreasing as we go over time. Now, again, let's just refresh ourselves, because sometimes people panic around debtor positions. And I'm going to tell you that debtor positions can rise or sink for various reasons. But let's get the maths right. You all understand our business model, which is we install engines, grow an annuity. There's a 4-to-1 ratio in terms of revenue and better margins. It is given maths that if we make better margins on the aftermarket than we do on the OE, we are always going to have a debtor. So the question is, we're building up a base And as we're in a growth phase, of course, we will have a growing debtor position. Eventually, obviously, the cash will start to catch up. This is a corresponding unlinked one. It's a fairly boring chart because it traps each other far closer. This is just the aftermarket, but again, this is the sort of thing that we would see on a program where they're close together. So, drivers of total care, net debtor, and I guess creditor as well for that matter. Obviously, as OE rises, if you get a ramp up in OE with linked contracts, you're going to drive up the debtor. As shop visits take place, we will also increase the debtor because, of course, we're retiring the creditor. And when we talk about a debtor, we tend to talk about a net debtor, which is obviously the gross debtor and the gross creditor positions coming together. So shop visits, obviously, we reduce the creditor, and that has a habit of increasing the debtor. When the contract outlook improves, so we talked about margin take. If we were taking 20% and actually, based on our cost progress and margin improvement, we actually thought, and reliability, we thought actually it should be 21%. That 1% increase increases the margin and helps to increase the debtor because it's just the difference between revenue and cost being accrued. On the other side, obviously, as we do flying hours, we get the cash in, it retires down the debtor. And interestingly, if we worsen the contract outlook, we have the reverse, obviously. So that results in the debtor reducing. And again, on the valuation allowance, it changes, and it can result in a rise or fall, depending on where we are. In steady state, valuation allowances come down over time. And again, as time reduces, counterparty risk. So let me just take you back to John's chart. So before I just go on to this, let's just remind ourselves. I've just given you one program. We've got eight programs, all at different points in the maturity cycle. You start laying those all over each other, and you can see that the modelling gets very, very complicated because there's many, many moving parts and thousands of engines, all at different points in their life cycle, on top of customers who are changing their flying patterns and habits, us working away diligently to improve reliability and cost. All of those things keep going in as we update. And the point is, you know, are we getting the mass right? The answer is yes. But it's, of course, the important point is understanding where we are in the cycle, and that drives the cash position. So John was quite clear in his chart in telling you where we are. We're seeing some big ramp-ups, certainly as we get into 16 and 17 periods. And, of course, this isn't just XWBs. Trent 700s continue, Trent 1000s continue, and various others that are going here. But as you can see, the revenues are rising. So generally, we're going to increase. That will be an increasing debtor as we go forward. Of course, the number of things that talk about the total debtor when we look at the entire portfolio are driven by what is linked versus what is unlinked, the differential margin between the two. And, of course, as we get around to these sort of areas, we get the benefit of volume. Learner curve gets out of the way in some of the new programs in the 1000, the XWB. Volume is our friend. We're rationalising the footprint. All of these things are going to improve cost and cash and obviously margins too. So that's just what is coming. This is just a picture of where we are today. To me, it's an embedded value chart of where we are. So these are our eight programmes showing their various points in terms of relative scale and contribution and size, just on total care. It does not include T&M. It does not include non-contracted business or speculative business. It's our position we stand today just on our existing total care contracts. As you can see, at the end, the RB211 programs, generally these guys are running, you know, together they combine, they're about sort of 35 to 40% on TCA. They're still very T&M weighted, this part. And as we go across, these are much more on TCA. And again, you know, as we go forward, we're sort of in the high 80s, 90%. And across the fleet, about 70-odd percent. The dark blue is just saying where we are in terms of what we banked and what is to come. And this excludes speculative business and, of course, negotiations of TCAs beyond their initial term. But the point here is there's a huge amount of embedded value with the better margins. So, let's just summarise where I think we are and what we'll try to do in a relatively short space of time of understand the principles of the accounting, the complexities as we build up single engine into programs, to running multiple programs over each other at multiple different points in their life cycle, lots of moving parts, and driving where we're going and why we're confident about what we're doing is the right thing. So earnings are ahead of cash whilst OE is growing, and you can see it growing. In some respect, we're sowing more than we're harvesting at the moment, but obviously we see the strong annuity that's driven off that installed base. There's significant value embedded in the aftermarket. Of course, as I've iterated before and John has, we're strongly focused on cost reduction, improving reliability. And again, as the last point, really, as I finish off here, is the accounting follows the commercial substance of the transaction, which is why I talked about the various contracts at the beginning, and our treatment has been agreed with the FRC. So that's the end of the accounting session. I'm now going to hand over to John. So thank you.
Thanks, Mark. It's very helpful and clear. So let me wrap things up. And I expect you're all expecting me to give the usual wrap-up that you would turn off for, because you know what I'm going to say. So excuse me if I do something different. I'm going to tell you what I feel rather than a recap of the business. And what I feel is privileged to lead this organisation. Great people, wonderful products, terrific company. A company that has done extraordinary things over many years. I'm in awe of the people who did this in the past, because they focused on the long term, not the short term, because they recognised the long term success that this business could have, and it's a long term business. I'm thoughtful about the growing pains that we're having and we will have. The growing pains that are a consequence of the success that we have, not of the failure. The growing pains that we'll experience, whether it's transforming the operational performance or the financial performance, we are going to feel those. But it's a consequence of success. I'm confident that we have sustainable growth. But that does not mean year after year consistent growth. It means long-term sustainable growth. And I hope you are excited about the future of this great company. So thanks very much indeed for coming today. We're going to take questions now, and we'll finish no later than 12:30. So what we're going to do is, we've got a number of people that are watching this on the phone lines or on computers. If you could type in your questions, we will pick those questions up during the course of the Q&A session. And I think, Jalinda, you'll read those out as we go across. What I'm going to ask is, if you put your hands up in the normal fashion, if you want to ask a question, if you could say who you are and the institution you represent, that would be very helpful. And if you could wait for the microphones to come round, because the session's being recorded, then we can make sure that we all hear the questions as well as hopefully the answers. Okay, let me try and be the ringmaster of this. And just to make it easy, we'll start at the front here. Work back and around, and when we come to Jalinda, we'll pick up some of the not in the room questions.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. It's Nick Cunningham from Agency Partners. I've got two sort of slightly different questions. One going back to the early part of the morning. I think you said that unit cost reductions are effectively offsetting increased input costs. I was wondering if you could give us something behind that as to what's happening to both gross numbers, if you like, and how you see that playing out over the near to medium term. And secondly, coming back to the more recent part, I believe that Trent XWB sales are going to be unlinked, perhaps all of them. I'm wondering if you could possibly explain why that is contractually, and also looking forward, Trent 1,900 and remaining 700 contracts. Are those all going to be linked, all going to be unlinked? What sort of proportionality are we looking at within each program? Thank you very much.
Certainly. Thanks, Nick. I'm going to pass a couple of those questions probably to Mark, but if I just give a couple of comments first. What I said was we had about 400 engineers working on our existing products and they were finding ways to reduce cost, and that was offsetting the escalation that we were seeing as part of the passage of time. So as you know, in our purchasing and through into our sales, we have escalation clauses. So they're finding ways to offset that escalation. You're right about XWB. They will be unlinked contracts in simple terms, and Mark will be more specific, I'm sure, is because we're selling it through essentially to Airbus and then on because we're the only engine on the aircraft. But Mark, maybe you want to make a couple of comments about both those questions as well.
Okay, well,
and the Trent 1000.
So let's just start with the linking, unlinking. So XWB is unlinked because it's sole source, or single source, should I say, and it's done through Airbus. So we've got two separate contracts because we're negotiating with Airbus but doing the aftermarkets contracts with the airline. So it doesn't pass the IS 11 test. On 1,700s, the majority are linked. We do have some unlinked. We have customers who have gone T&M and changed their minds further down the road, so you can have both, but the majority are linked. I think on the cost side, I mean, we've talked about this before, Nick. There's an array of activities that are ongoing, and, you know, it's a journey we're on. We're sort of in the foothills of where we think we can get to on cost, but a lot of activity, be it low-cost country sourcing, designing for cheaper, is, you know, renegotiating our supply contracts and some of that coming through as well. So while some might be eating the headwinds, there's other activity which will continue to drive those costs down. And, of course, some of that we're talking about, which, you know, which is included in our guidance for this year as well.
Okay, if we just go... Thanks, Emma.
That's great. Thanks very much. Couple of questions.
Could you say your name?
Rob Stallard from RBC.
Thank you.
First of all, maybe we'll stick with the total care accounting. The estimation risk that you take on the contracts, I was wondering if you'd give us an idea of what sort of percentage you're talking about here and how the profile is expected to develop on this going forward. And then the second question is actually on the RB211. You've said that the thrust profile is a proxy for revenue. But I was wondering if you can give us an idea of whether that's also a proxy for profitability as well.
Mark, I'm going to throw both of those at you because you're the accounting man for this. And
So estimation risk. I think I gave you some insights into the impact our experiences. I mean, our experiences have been pretty good. We recognise that there's always been a small error bar around what's actually happening. Like I said, 1% is about 30 million in year in terms of where we are on the portfolio, and the impact to date we've seen is about plus or minus 4% on in-year profits within civil. We're not going to reveal what the current estimation risk that we're holding at the moment, but I think within those bands you can see as we track through what our experiences are to date. So what I would say is that when I look back to the CFO and talk to the businesses and say, well, how confident are we about our cost modelling? And what I'm seeing, actually, we're tracking pretty good. And generally, the curve has been one of it coming down through improved reliability and some of the things that Tony talked about. Now, your second question, I think, was thrust a good proxy for value. I think the rawest sense, absolutely, it is. I mean, clearly, bigger value off bigger thrust engines, but then you have to be a little bit more explicit about what's happening within any engine program. So if I took RB211, for example, it's about 20% of thrust, and I think last year is somewhere around sort of 14-15% of revenues. Why is that? That will just reflect the flying patterns potentially of the airlines. So in the RB211s, there's a lot of freighters. They don't tend to fly quite as many hours. And of course, because it's the longer point in the cycle, there's an element of us trying to make sure we incentivize people to stay on so we can be sometimes reducing our margin as a way of making sure that we keep the fleet flying for longer. And that's just sort of what I call efficient frontier analysis, which is how do we keep it running for longer while still making margin. So that's the driver. So first order, yes. Second order, not necessarily.
I'm not sure, Mark, whether I think the question was more about the is the thrust also a proxy for profit as well as revenue? Just to be difficult help the questioner out.
I mean, yes, the short answer is yes, again, yes. It is. But again, depending on where we are on the programmes and where we are on the cycle, that will vary it.
Okay. Anybody else on this? I'm going to come back. Let's just go... yep, that's great, and we'll come back to the front of the moment.
Thanks. It's David Perry from JP Morgan. Tony, can I ask you, if you had one company, Civil Aerospace, could you just give us a feel for roughly what percentage of the profit is coming from the three segments you talk about? For example, in the annual report, so if we were to think about large engines, medium engines, and small engines, can you just tell us roughly what profit contribution to, say, in 13, each made to the business?
David, thank you for deciding who would answer the questions, but I'm going to impose a slightly different view and suggest that that Mark starts off with that and then maybe Tony has something else to comment.
Good question.
Well, I thought. David, I mean, we don't break out sub-levels. We give it at the civil division level. And, you know, civil and defence is what we give within aero. You know, we're not going to start breaking out our various programmes.
If I may ask a follow-up, I think your communication around IAE has been very confusing. I think you've sought to rectify it with a slide today where you've added a dotted piece for IAE to show it's still sort of part of the business, although it's not your official thrust, which is a change in the old, in your previous slides. So thanks for that. Clearly, it is still contributing revenue and a very lot of profit, but it is extremely hard to know the outlook for that. And before I even begin to think about TotalCare and the Trent, it'd be quite nice to know what's going on with IAE today and in the future, please.
Mark, do you want to make any comments on that?
Yeah, look, I mean, we've said as we go forward, it gets progressively more and more difficult to make relative impacts of old versus new. We've been clear in terms of the guidance we've given in the past about the contribution it's made and the numbers that you've got, and it will continue to contribute, certainly for the foreseeable future, certainly the next decade, but it will decline over time. But we're not going to break out sort of forward guidance going out for one piece of the programme. It just becomes part of the portfolio eventually, which is where we are.
Tony, have you anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's real value. We sell engines still on the VC500 to Pratt & Whitney. We sell spare parts, and we have 5,000 engines at the point at which we exited IAE that generate a dollar per flying hour going forwards, and that's what the shaded line on that graph represented.
Yeah, to finish on a positive note on that question, again, I would remind everybody that the value that you generally was assumed by the market for our IAE business was a little lower than we actually realised. And that, again, is the installed value, the value of the installed base within this business, which is a large part of the value of the company. And that's why we spent so much time explaining where we think the thrust is going to grow. That is a huge value of this organisation. Okay, question right at the front here, and I'll go to the back on the other side.
Rami Myerson from Investec. Three questions. At the beginning in your presentation, you talked about the taking out costs, but then you presented the slide of the ramp-up in the Trent engines, which presents a number of headwinds to profitability. Is it right to think that, you know, talking about, and of course you also talked about closing the margin gap, but that is something that's probably going to happen towards the back end of this decade. It's not going to happen over the next few years. The second question is on medium-speed recips. Given that you've announced this morning you don't plan on making significant M&A, how should we think about the R&D profile in the marine business? Are we going to see a big ramp-up? And just a short one on the ROIC over WACC comment on Tognum. Can you just update us where we are in that process, given we're about 3 years since the acquisition?
Okay, I'll take I run at the first couple and ask Mark on the third, and maybe any of their comments go on the other ones. In terms of the ramp up, headwinds. I use the term growing pains when I talked about it, and Mark has spent some time explaining linked and unlinked, and we've just hopefully clarified around the XWB in terms of the fact that that's unlinked. So there's a whole raft of things going on in that mix. That's why I talk about growing pains in terms of operational performance and financial performance. So how do we address those issues? How do we address the consequences of our success? How do we drive through to the if you like, the promised land out in the future when we've got strong growth and more stability. And it's an issue for all, you know, growing companies or companies that are growing at a significant rate, is how do you keep pace with that? Because it's not just the points that you made, it's also some of the other points I made earlier in terms of the investment in new capacity. So if I look back at some of the margin progression from 3 to 13, a large part of that was on the back of the revenue growth, but it was also on the back of the fact that we underinvested, if I can be slightly critical, in the infrastructure of the business, and we're having to catch that up now, which is one of the growing pains that we're going through. We will give you in October, as Mark has said, our view about the medium-term outlook in the format that he's talked about, which I believe will help address some of your questions. And clearly, as Mark has also explained in terms of guidance, we're going to be giving more in the future than we have in the past, which will help you and hopefully manage expectations. But your point is the right one, and it's one that we are reflecting on, which is why I've made the points I've made while we've talked in the way that we've talked, which is we're grappling with the growing pains of the current because of the success that we've had to get to the future where we've got this sustainable growth and a more steady state position. In terms of medium speed, if I look at the total business, as Mark and I have both said, what we expect on research and development costs is at most an easing of that as a percentage of revenue, and we can rebalance where we spend our money. So if I break it down, our civil spend runs what, Mark, about 5% or so?
Yep.
Net? Marine has been much lower than that, about 2.5.
Two-ish.
But our new acquisition, Rolls-Royce Power Systems, has been running about 7%. And what I would say is, in our medium speed, a lot of the investment, understanding, knowledge, technology, capability is within that Rolls-Royce Power Systems business, where they've been investing a lot of money, whether it's to address emissions concerns, more power, etc. So one of the big advantages we've got with owning that business is that we can use that knowledge, experience and wisdom to help us grow the medium speed and invest organically, whether that's in new products with more power, more fuel efficiency, different fuel types, all of which we are doing. So you shouldn't expect sort of some huge increase in R&D as a consequence of organic growth in the medium speed business. It's part of the total, and it's really a question of how we balance that total across the whole business. And Mark, I don't know if you can put in some perspective. I mean, the marine R&D is actually very, very small relative to, for example, the civil business. So even if we were to double the marine R&D, frankly, it's still relatively small in terms of sums of money.
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of around 30 to 40 million.
Mark, do you want to talk a little bit about return on invested capital and WACC?
If I have to, yes. I thought I'd get this question. Let's just remind ourselves on Tognum. We only took management control just over a year ago, and we'll only take 100% ownership probably at the end of Q3, Q4 this year. And again, that's subject to the regulatory approvals, and it's just whatever their caseload is on how stuff goes through. Obviously, when we get 100% control, then we can really start to grind out some of the efficiencies. It hasn't been that we haven't been doing stuff. Like I said, we're encouraged by what we've seen. We're excited by the business. Both John has talked about some of the sort of cross-selling opportunities that we're getting already, certainly in our naval marine business and sort of the high yacht end and so forth. So there are things going on already. We haven't been sort of resting on our laurels. I think it's worth saying that obviously it's been a relatively tough market, I think, for that part of the market, but we see good prospects going forward. So certainly encouraged from where we are at the moment. We haven't got to the point of my end of my test yet, as it were. We'll be grinding stuff out as soon as we get going.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is when we were doing a joint venture and before the squeeze out, we were looking at really revenue opportunities, as we always said when we announced the deal. Now we're going to own 100% of it. We're going to get the revenue opportunities, and we'll be able to manage those more directly. And I talked a little bit about some of those revenue opportunities when I was talking about medium speed, the pull through working that way. And now we've got the opportunity to get cost synergies, which we didn't really have in the past because we're going to own 100% of the business. Please, can I just grab the microphone again?
Just to clarify, at the moment, ROIC on Tognum is not higher than WACC on the deal?
No.
Okay, we're going to move back to the back. Gelinda, why don't we have a question from outside of the room?
So we have a call a question from Toby Cram from DeBros, and it's a two-part question, or two separate questions. Cash conversion is low, you indicated, until the inflection point in 2018. But what about absolute free cash flow growth, given the revenue growth that should be coming on the steeper ramp of the Trents? And the second part of Toby's question is R&D declines as a percentage of revenues. Is that true, even with the narrow-body push?
Mark, do you want to talk a little bit about cash conversion?
Yes, I mean, obviously that was referred to just at the in relation to the civil wide-body part of the program, of course. Across all our other businesses, I would say that when we talk about our marine and obviously energy at the moment, all that goes, and our power systems, nuclear businesses, generally they're much more what I call traditional industrial businesses in terms that when you look at the revenue and the percentage you get on profit and the cash conversion, they move far more in sync. I mean, there are obviously movements on cash conversion. On the civil business, and particularly most acutely in the civil wide-body part of the business, we do get much bigger swings just because the investment cycles are far longer and far deeper. So in terms of cash conversion on that part, again, as John alluded to, we see that coming out and sort of towards the 2018 period. But obviously, there are ongoing activity across all the other parts of the business for the group that are driving cash. So we're not going to give medium-term guidance today, but obviously, directionally, as we said before, we're very focused on driving both cost and cash. Do you want to answer the R&D one as well? So I think the R&D question, just to make sure we've got it for the question, was that we've said currently, at, 4.9%. It'll ease gradually over time as revenues grow. I don't think it will be linear. It's a function of activity. But when we think about R&D, it's predominantly people. It's our sort of 18,000 engineers, what they're doing, plus some hardware. When we normally look out over the radar in terms of what we can do from our human capital, we end up with what we call an R&D wedge, which is today the load capacity balance, which has all of Collins' engineers working on various programs, be it in civil or any other parts of the business. They're fully consumed. But as we look forward, obviously, if nothing else happens, they'll run out of things to do. And, of course, those wedges are what we're filling up with potential new programs, which will obviously include narrow body, which realistically, if we sort of say it's middle of the next decade, would sort of start in terms of a sort of 18-19 period. But let's just remember that's MPI, the R&D. The research and technology part of that is very generic and compliant to multiple programs. And the R&T line, of course, in terms of what we're doing there, continues. And I don't know if Colin would like to mention anything on R&D in terms of what we're doing and how we're looking at it.
Well, only that broadly the R&T research and technology programs that we're doing for the big engines flow down to the middle of the market engines as well. So it's not duplication. You just decide how you which product you point that technology to.
If I could just add what I said when I was talking about cash conversion, I pointed at 2018, a couple of things I said. Delivering the cost and the benefits that we get through that, driving through the changes that I talked about when I talked about cost, and I said as we start to stabilise, we'll see an improvement in cash conversion. I also said, assuming no new major programmes, which are, in some ways you could say the narrow body potentially is, and the issue there is, are we spending it on our existing programs or new programs similar to our existing programs, and is it additional or is it substitutional? So the point that I would make, and I make it whenever I speak to you because I know that cash is conversion is a critical point, is as we're growing and investing for growth, in simple terms, that clearly uses up cash. As we get to a steadier state, the cash conversion will improve. So the challenge there is, how much can we grow in the future and where are you spending that cash versus reducing the growth relative to the cash spend? That's the only point that I would add. Okay, let's go right to the back of the room and then we'll come down to the front.
Good morning, Charles Armitage at UBS. Two questions. First of all, on accounting for long-term contracts or total care, I understand that a conservative company, when you're accounting for long-term contracts, would start with lower profits or lower margin recognition and end up at higher margin recognition. Normally, I'd call the difference of that contingency. Is that what you call estimation risk, or is there a contingency in there as well?
No, we don't refer to it as contingency. I mean, there's lots of, it is a cautious best estimate of what we put aside to recognise that there will be a small error bar. And the level of estimation, so I mean, if I just separate the two out, valuation risk, valuation allowance is different. Estimation risk will vary depending on our experience. So clearly a very mature program like an RB211, frankly, the estimation risk is very small, and of course it's slightly larger that we allow for on a new program like, you know, whether it's XWB or 1000. And again, we have sort of, we track the behavioural characteristics, the architecture, the similarities, how it will respond, and that's what sort of Colin and his team, along with the people in civil, will work out carefully and follow with various algorithms that we use. So, I mean, I guess contingency is one word. If you want to use it, it's not a word that we would use. And because obviously contingency doesn't exist in accounting.
And just to follow that one on, the 25% illustrative margin on a linked contract.
Yep.
Orders of magnitude, are we talking small, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% estimation risk on a, and I understand, on the XWB, for instance, or is it half your margin?
No, it's certainly not half your margin. It's a number of percentage points, but I'm not going to get into the details.
Okay. And the second question is on medium-speed diesel. Now you've said there are no material acquisitions planned. Medium-speed diesel is 7% of 2 billion, which I make 140 million. So it's less than 1% of your overall business, yet it's top the fifth of your five priorities. So what is the strategy? Number five of your five priorities seems to be quite important, but under 1% of your overall sales doesn't seem very important at all.
Well, as I tried to explain during the course of the meeting, the reason I'm concentrating on it is it completes the portfolio in many ways, and will help us drive sales and revenue across the marine business, and also it creates opportunities in land power as well. We see it as a growth market. We see it as an opportunity. That's why it's there.
But at 3% GDP type growth, it's going to take an awfully long time for that to become organically a particularly meaningful thing. So how big do you see medium speed diesel in 2020? Or a number of years out?
If you look at how you can address these issues, you've got sort of three. You've got organic growth, and we're doing that, as I said. You've got partnerships. We've had a partnership in the past with Hyundai, as it happens to be. Or you can do mergers and acquisitions of varying sizes. You can look at any of those as in terms of how you can address that gap in our portfolio. So, or I guess all I'm saying is the reason that it's important for us is that it's where we're weaker. So the numbers that you're quoting at me saying it's only a small belt is exactly why it's important, because it completes the circle of the product offering that we have, and we have the capability to do well in that area. That's why it's important.
So if I could just follow on one more. I think you've said in the past 65% of an offshore marine vessel is your components.
It can be up to.
Can be up to. Yeah. How much of that is the engine?
How much is the engine? Laurie, do you know?
Oh, £1 million.
How much percentage do you
think? In percentage terms, a very small percentage, but it's the pull-through that's really important, yep, from that engine that builds up to the 65%. It's the deck machinery, for example. It's the kind of supply systems on the ship design that we pull through. It's designing the auxiliary systems. It's designing the stabilizer systems. That engine pulls through quite a lot of content.
It also, as I said when I was presenting, is where you get the aftermarket, far more importantly.
And final point. Final little thing. How much to know? You know, 1 million on an engine is 10% of an OPV typically.
Sorry, I can't remember.
A million on the engine. I haven't bought many OPVs recently. What's a typical?
It depends on the type of vessel that you buy and the complexity of the vessel. So an anchor handle will cost an awful lot more than a supply ship, etc. So. When we talk about this, the 60%, that we generally talk about is a fully loaded anchor handle of vessel is where we've got that, where we've got winches on board, we've got our thrusters on board, we've got our propulsion system on board, where we've got the captain's chair, we've got the dynamic positioning system on board, and the engine. And what we've got, if you look back in history, is we've had a very strong position within Norway because that's where our strength and history is. As the industry expands and changes and diversifies, it's been important, it will be important, to get a broader engine offering than we have today to help drive the pull-through that we've had successfully in Norway in the past. And that's why we want to address that gap in our portfolio. Yeah, let's go over to the floor.
Thank you. So Zafar Khan from SocGen. I've got three questions, please. The first one is just a follow-on from Charlie's question on the medium speed. And I just want to ask in very simple terms what Charlie was asking in a very kind of long-winded way, if I put it that way. Can you achieve your ambition in medium speed diesel without M&A? That's the first question. And
Give us all three.
The second one, just wanted to say, Mark, thank you very much for an excellent explanation on the accounting, but I think I've fallen on the final hurdle on that one. It's just conclusion on page 24, the debtor rising due to shop visits taking place. Isn't that debtor falling if there's a shop visit rather than rising?
No, the debtor will rise.
Let's take all. Have you got a third one?
Yeah, please. and
I'm learning.
The third one is just on the confirmation of the 2014 guidance that you've given in the statement. And I remember from the IMS, you suggested that there would be a one-third, two-third phasing in that profit this year. Historically, we've never been that wide between the two halves. I can understand some of the shortfall, if I can put it that way, in H1 against H1 in 13. But in order to get to the full year guidance you've given and then the H1, H2 split, I can't make the numbers add up at all. So I'd be very grateful if you could provide a little bit of color in terms of the divisions on how we get to that one-third, two-third split based on the full year guidance you've given.
Okay, let's go back to the first one. Organic growth. The short answer is yes. So if we were sitting here in 1990 and talking about wide body, and we said that we were going to have 50% of the wide body share, I suspect there would have been a level of scepticism. But here we are today with 50% of the wide body share, and we've done that organically from about sort of 2%. So, yes, you could do it. The only question is, are you determined to do it, and how long does it take? That's all it's about. So if you put the investment in, you could do it. But there are other methods by which you could do it. So the fact that it's a priority doesn't say it's something that I must resolve tomorrow or the day after or the world comes to an end. This is a long-term business, and I'm looking at long-term issues. The narrow body, and similarly, is not an issue for today or tomorrow, but, as I explained in my presentation, it's an opportunity, I think, for us for significant growth. It's a market that we should be in. We're going to get back in. So it isn't something that I have to fix today, but it's certainly something that I and others worry about in terms of the long-term thinking of the business. Mark, maybe you want to talk about debtors' shop visits and maybe something on guidance.
Right, okay. So, Zafar, just to make sure I've got your question, I think you're saying that debtor rises as shop visits take place. You don't think that's correct? Let me just explain. So, net debtor, gross debtor, creditor, before we start. If we think about what's happening on the cost side, we're building up a creditor, we're accruing costs, and then when we spend the money, the creditor's retired. So when you take that away from the gross debtor position, before you were taking a creditor, let's say, of 100, now you do your overhaul, the creditor's reduced to zero, you've got nothing to take away, so the debtor will rise, all things being equal. That's all it is. Yeah? Okay. So that was that one. Now sort of the easy one, H1, H2 guidance for this year, I think, is what you're... So let me just try and remind everybody what we said was just in terms of guidance this year. We said, look, broadly one-third, two-thirds, H1, H2, a bit more acute than usual
Revenue, just to be clear, is about 15% higher in H2, a little bit higher than last year. So volume is driving part of it. And again, much of that driven by actually all of the divisions, but more specifically on the MIPS part, business, power systems, and marine. Cost reduction, we're seeing more cost reduction coming in as contractual cost reductions kick in and the volume benefits kick in H2. You heard me talk about restructuring back at the prelims. There's about 90 million total, about 30 million higher than last year, all happening predominantly weighted towards the front end. That's mainly in aerospace, both indirects and directs. R&D is the other one, again, I sort of signalled. And again, that's predominantly being driven by spend patterns around the Trent program being a little bit more weighted H1. And then finally, on the marine side, of course, we took a product quality charge of 30 million. So that's sort of where we are. And, you know, like I said, that's, you know, we've maintained our guidance. We've confirmed that today. So I'm not going to break out all the separate divisions, but you've got an idea in terms of where the main things are coming from.
Okay, let's continue to circle down this side. Go ahead.
Hi there, Selvan Massel, Westray Capital. Just looking at the benefit of Total Care, can you quantify what benefit, if any, you get from the fact you have such a high market share on the maintenance on a program that's got 90% under Total Care, making it, if at all, making it harder for third-party overhaulers later in that program to compete, given you've taken all the used part early on? And related to that, can to give some numbers around that, you know, on a Total Care program, maybe an engine or as a program as a whole, how much more money would you expect to make off a Trent XWB because it's got such a high Total Care versus an RB211 if it was here today, all on time on materials? That doesn't need to be per an engine. It could be just looking at the program as an overall.
So I'll ask Tony to make a couple of comments. I think the first thing to say is that this is a really competitive market. And the reason that we and the airlines like Total Care is that it aligns our interests and their interests together. That's the attraction for both parties and why airlines would generally want to choose that. It's a level of risk, but our interests are aligned. What do I mean by that? I mean, we both want to keep the engine on wing for as long as possible. The airline for obvious reasons in terms of operational performance, us for obvious reasons in terms of cost performance. But this is a very competitive market, so when we sell these products into the market, this isn't about trying to control the market in some shape, size or form. Competitive, there are ways that, that we're selling other engines, other products. Our competitors sell them. How do you sell them? How do you compete against them? So there is, you know, quite intense competition around these markets. Tony, you want to make any comments?
I think in terms of how the maintenance is provided, there's a number of options. So there's Rolls-Royce wholly owned facilities, there's joint ventures in which Rolls-Royce is involved, and there's also independent shops. So there are independent shops in Japan, in the Middle East, with our relationships with some of the Middle Eastern carriers, in Air France there will be for the future. So I think, you know, there's a number of options, and dependent on, you know, what the airline strategy is, you know, are they going to have a big maintenance infrastructure and want to participate in that, or are they happy to come to a Rolls-Royce facility or a Rolls-Royce joint venture? It depends what the airline's strategy is, but there are options, those three options.
What I'm trying to get to is, I mean, do you think you'll make more money profits from a program that's got a high Total Care penetration, absolute dollars, versus if you didn't have Total Care? I mean, do you have to sacrifice something in profits to get the stability?
So I think it's quite clear that there is risk transfer going on, as John's explained, on a Total Care contract, and for that we seek to generate a better margin. Within the business is on having the most efficient maintenance footprint in terms of driving productivity, driving repair technology. You know, that's the focus. That's the bit where our intellectual property sits that gives us the confidence that we can deliver those margins. But absolutely, we seek and should secure a better margin as a result of that risk transfer. That's the premium.
OK, we'll come on round. Okay, just a few at the front. Pick them off one at a time.
I guess three quick questions. You guys keep
name
alluding...
And,
Mason Tollimer from Samlin Capital. You guys keep alluding to 2018 being sort of maybe a pivotal year. Are we supposed to understand that as maybe 2017 is when we see the peak in the total of the net debtor and the wreck engine loss account, or whatever we're calling it these days, and that going forward after that, cash will be above earnings as we draw those balance sheet items down. That's the first one. Second one, it sounds like you guys are committing to, in October, giving us longer-term guidance. You guys have had in the past talked about over the medium-term margins expanding. Could you at least give us a teaser today? Could you commit to margins expanding over the medium term without giving the exact numbers, as maybe you've done already in the past? And then the third question is, it would seem logical that the contingency on a linked program would be much higher than an unlinked program, as you're recognizing more of the profits up front. Is that true, and is there a way to think about an order of magnitude between the two of them?
Okay, let me deal with these. As I said about 2018, that's when, according to the chart, the projection we've got, we start to see things evening out. We've gone through a number of years and we've called growing pains. We'll have done a lot of the work that we're doing on cost. And I said that that's the kind of year that we would expect to see an improvement in cash conversion, subject to not having any major new programs that would change that profile. And that's the only comment that I would make on that topic. In terms of margins, October's not too far away. We'll wait till October, teasers or otherwise. And Mark, you want to address the linked and unlinked?
Yes. The short answer is the maths in the accounting drives what we do. So the estimation risk, when we look at it, is we treat a linked contract as a whole. So when we assess what we think the estimation risk is, we then obviously apply it to the entire contract. So by definition, if you've got an OE element in terms of the implication, in terms of dollar terms or pound terms, yes, it has a bigger impact because we treat it as one. Whereas obviously with a pure unlinked aftermarket, you haven't got the front end revenue and costs to consider. But does it actually affect our margin in terms of, no, it's how we're thinking about the cost looking through the OE is delivered and the cost is known. So the driver of the estimate is driven by our cost assumption and what I'll call the sort of small error bar in terms of how we, you know, try and make sure we've got a sensible line going forward. It's our best estimate. But let's be clear, it is an estimate looking forward 10, 15, 20 years. So once we've assessed that, we then apply it because the rules require us to apply it in terms of evening the margins on linked. And therefore, we take the margin based on flying hours flown, and that's all factored in. Okay.
Could you pass the microphone one to the left, and then we'll go one to the left again, and we're done. Okay?
Great. Thank you. Christian Lachlan from Bernstein. How successful have efforts been so far to extract costs and better terms out of your supplier base? And kind of related to that, do you expect to find greater success in newer engine programs like XWB versus, say, Trent 700? Or because of supplier overlap, you're able to exert some leverage on both? And then finally, relating to that, in terms of the timing or phasing, just realizing that these sort of cost improvement efforts do take time, what's your sort of general view on how the phasing or the positive impact of the benefit will be resulting in or ending up in the financials?
Okay, thanks. I think your second question is, could you give me medium-term guidance today again? And we'll deal with that in October, and we'll give you some clues around that. And we'll reflect on these questions. And I'm not trying to be flippant about it, but we understand the question and the interest. In terms of the supplier base, maybe I'll ask Tony to make a few comments because he's been involved in this. I think my summary will be mixed, and it's mixed for all the obvious reasons. If I put our suppliers into three unfair buckets, sort of ones where you've got good negotiation leverage, one where you've got some negotiation leverage, and one where you've got no, guess where you make progress and where you don't. So if you look across the supplier base, it's always easier to make more progress in the first part. So we are making progress. If we look at our programs, in terms of the number of suppliers that we have, we've reduced it significantly. Go back in history, hundreds and hundreds of suppliers, XWB less than 100. That changes the negotiation dynamic significantly. And yes, where we can link past and future together, it gives more volume, and that then helps into the first bucket of suppliers. The other thing that I would say is, having worked in the car industry and observed the car industry, they went through a whole raft of relationship issues with suppliers about how they could or couldn't manage it. And you know, what I would say is we should learn from that. And the real learning, I would suggest, and others may disagree, and certainly there's at least one person in the room with a lot more knowledge of the car industry than me, is to make sure that you have a firm relationship and partnership with your critical suppliers where you both benefit rather than trying to push them underwater for a period of time just to get a bit of price now. The other complexity that we have is around the length of the programs, the old programs, the nature of the beast, the regulatory environment that makes it a more complicated and generally longer discussion. Tony, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, no, I think you've covered most of it, but I think the point on reducing the number of suppliers, I mean, Rolls-Royce Aerospace today, 135 suppliers is 80% of the value of equipment that we buy in our engines. That is a dramatically smaller number over the last decade. You know, I can get them in a room and have this conversation with the aerospace team. We did it in Heathrow only a few weeks ago. It's a continual process. It does require us to be a partner, to look at the specifications. You know, we get into a lot of detail to liberate cost out of every component and every system that we buy. But there is the reality of, you know, the complexity of the different parts in the engine versus the competitive position. You know, we do have those suppliers who have proprietary equipment and systems and capability in our engines, and those are the ones where we have, you know, a much deeper and more partnered relationship to drive cost out. But it's very much a two-way relationship that we're developing, and I think our posture is really important in that. And we're getting traction. We're working our way through offsetting the escalation piece, the sort of pressures that our suppliers face as well, and then getting beneath on, you know, the real things that drive cost, inspection requirements that we put on for our engines and the other elements of the design, and really working much more closely with them. So it's a long-term drive to get cost.
I'm going to go one further to the left, and then we're going to go to the back for an external question, then we'll come circling around again.
Yes, it's Ben Fidler from Deutsche. Got three questions, it may surprise you. The first one was just a fairly simple one on the buyback duration period, this £1 billion, just to help me understand your intention as to how we should think about the time period over which you will execute that. I know some of that may be out of your control in terms of market volumes and price volatility, but do you see that as a 2-year program? Is it a 5-year program? That would be helpful to bound it. The second one is just on CapEx. Thank you for the additional detail you've given us on the rate of decline in tangible CapEx, down from the 4.9%. You spent about £500 million last year. Intangible CapEx was £500 million. Could you help me understand how that will progress, the intangible CapEx line, over the next 3 to 5 years, over that corresponding period? That would be very helpful. And the final one is just coming back maybe to the supply chain cost reduction activity, and just so I've understood the messaging correctly, you're saying your 400 engineers and the activity that you're undertaking at the moment with supply chain cost reduction is basically going to see flat, we should think flat procurement cost. We shouldn't think down, in that I think a while ago my understanding was you were targeting 15% reduction in bought-in cost from the supply chain, which is about a £4 billion cost item over a 3-year period. So just to understand how I should think about that, that would be helpful.
Okay, yep. We start with the buyback. Mark, do you want to make a comment on the buyback time period?
So just on the buyback, again, it's subject to the energy deal concluding and getting the regulatory approvals that it needs, which we are... Our working assumption is that will be sort of by the year end. If that goes according to plan, then again, I think you've alluded to that some of these things are out of our control, but certainly our plan wouldn't be looking at sort of many years. It would be at a sensible level, a sensible run rate. Like I said, it's a discrete set of proceeds, and we'll do it in a orderly manner through the various exchanges and the usual sort of mechanisms that we stick in place. But you know, like I said, some of it's out of our control, so I can't be explicit, but certainly we're not looking to eke it out over over many years. That's not our intention, certainly.
CapEx, Mark?
So tangible CapEx, talked about. On intangible CapEx, of course, one of the sort of big drivers there really is Rex, and we're still going to start to get into medium-term guidance territory, which we're sort of holding off more for September. There are obviously other areas, but no, we haven't given any guidance at this stage on where it is. But obviously, it's an area we look at as well.
Can I just ask why you have to go in Okay, we withdraw the CapEx guidance. Does that help? I mean, I think what I would say there is sort of is sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Is that's yeah, we're going to drive that down, and that's quite clear, and that's something that we can do. And one of the observations I've made in all companies is actually I can control CapEx spend at the centre, and we can achieve, and we can look at that quite comfortably and work out what we're going to do. For the more specific guidance that we've talking about, that Mark's outlined, we want to go through a much more thoughtful and rigorous process and really consider what it is we think is right to do that. That's the difference. In terms of the supply chain, you mentioned the 15%, and certainly that was a sort of headline number a year or so ago. Yeah, we kind of go out to the supply chain and say, you know what, we want a big reduction, sort of, yeah. And anybody who sits here and thinks that all your suppliers say, oh, yeah, sure, no problem at all, here's 15%, or whatever it happens to be, obviously hasn't been in a supplier negotiation. But what it does is it sets the bar in terms of saying, we're serious about this. This isn't sort of a half a percent or 50p off kind of thing. It's a big program. And then you get straight back into what I describe as the three buckets. And also the suppliers that we talked to at that point in time were fewer, and we've now expanded those discussions, as Tony was saying. Tony, anything you want to add?
No, I think we're tackling it. So we started with the top 50 suppliers with the 15%, 5% per year over 3 years. We've made good traction on some areas of that. We're still working on some of the more complex relationships with the more complex systems. And we're making traction. And it takes time to deliver these programs. And it is related to some of the engineering work that we're doing as well in terms of looking at where we can put easements in that help suppliers take cost out, as well as the commercial leverage and the negotiation that volume and some of the other growth that we're seeing brings.
Laurie, anything to add on the MIP side?
Yes, I will. I'd say that the discussions we've had with our suppliers about cost cutting have been improving over the last 6-9 months because we've been able to demonstrate that we are cost cutting. And I think that it's an important part of the relationship that John talked about, is to be able to demonstrate that internally we're taking the appropriate actions as well as asking our suppliers to do that. So we're getting more traction because we're able to demonstrate our own position.
Good point. Let's go to the back. Jalinda, from outside of the room.
We have a question from Tal Eloya at Integer Asset Management. Two questions. Can you please discuss the risks associated with the XWB program? It's a large portion of your future growth. And the second question from Tal is, what are the risks of further meaningful decline in defense profits?
Okay, we could talk about risk from a number of different perspectives. What I would say on XWB, to cut that kind of short, is we're in very good shape on the XWB. Colin, do you want to make a few comments about where we are in terms of that program and what's going on?
Well, we certified the engine late last year. We're in the middle of the endurance program to make sure that we've got the maintainability and the reliability that we're predicting, and it's looking very good in line with prediction. We're just over halfway through the flight test program. There's 5 aircraft, I think, currently flying. And by the way, we're tracking them all the time in the data being streamed off the aircraft, bringing it back in, and as Tony said, showing how it validates against our design models. So everything's looking extremely good.
And we've delivered, I think, Tony, the first 2 production engines.
We have, to
Toulouse for Qatar, which is the launch customer for the A350, which should be going out later this year. So I think we're in a pretty good place in terms of XWB. Risks in terms of defence, where we're kind of getting back into guidance there. I'll go back to what we've said. Yeah, we've confirmed the guidance for this year and what we said about 2015, but I'm not going to get drawn into more detail at this stage. Okay, let's go to this gentleman here because we're circling around.
Steve Farley from Farley Capital. Question regarding the relationship between improving your on-time delivery and your cost structure. What is the relationship between improving the on-time delivery to internal plan and reducing costs? In order to improve the on-time delivery to internal plan, do you first need to increase costs, or are they going down as you're improving?
Okay, it's a great question. What I showed you was that we don't deliver very well to our internal plan. And the way that we then get from our internal plan to deliver to customers on time is that we create a buffer between the two. And the buffer is, for the sake of this discussion, time and material. So you create time by which you get the material coming in, by which you get a chance to finish the engine so you can get it to your customer on time. So if the buffer is this wide, and at the moment I'm only delivering 25% to the internal plan and the rest is coming in over the course of this buffer, then I have one financial effect. If I get this to 100% and leave the buffer the same, that will increase my cost and increase our inventory because I end up holding 100% for longer rather than 75% for less, to use my numbers. So the challenge is we've got to get stability into the supply chain and into the delivery to plan so we get towards 100%, and then you close the gap. So it's a two-stage process. We can and we will do that, and all businesses go through this as they mature from a low volume to a high volume, and that ripples around the supply chain. So as I was saying, it's an important element of our cost and cash in terms of inventory turns, in terms of the cost that we build into the system as a consequence of the buffers, and it takes time because you've got to get the stability at this level and then drive it through in terms of reducing the buffers as you get confidence. But as I also said, we've already reduced the lead times, for example, on the Trent 700 engine. So this isn't sort of you've got to get everything right and then you can do it. This is the stability and confidence that you have in individual programs. And as you know, the Trent 700 is our largest volume program, and we've made very good progress on that. But there are other programs, other new engines, for example, where we are behind where I'd like us to be. So it will take some time. Okay, go with the follow-up.
Are you saying you've stopped increasing the buffer, or is the buffer still increasing?
We have started to reduce the buffer. Yeah. So we have started to reduce the buffer in terms of material, and we started to do that around the whole supply chain. So if you were talking about our suppliers, we have reduced load, we've taken load out to start reducing the buffer. So we've started that process already. We've been doing that now for, I don't know, 9 months or so?
Yeah, over a year.
And it's a gradual process. So in an example, if I've got a three-month buffer, I could turn everything off for 3 months if I'm confident, but that doesn't make any sense. You bring it down slowly, and that's what we're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah, we've got one right at the very front here. We're going to get soon to the this is probably the next to last question, so we're going to have the last question after this.
Thank you. Tristan Sanson, Exxon BNP Paribas. I have a few questions on TCA accounting for Mark. So first one, TCA or Total Care Life, should we care on in terms of accounting compared to a traditional Total Care agreement? Is there any difference on profit and cash recognition? Second, if we look at a renewed Total Care agreement, should we just see that as a traditional unlinked contract, or should we look at different costs and revenues assumption for it? And then the third one, you gave a margin and cash profile for a traditional linked contract. But if we look at the traditional linked program, if we look at the total life of a program, which would start with a linked contract, but with then renewal of TCAs as unlinked, what would be the total or the adjustment which we should look at to the margin and cash profile of that program to get a comprehensive view of what's happening really on a program like the Trent 700 or something like that?
Wow, pretty detailed questions. Mark, I don't know if you want to give a high-level answer to those, or maybe I suggest you talk with the IR team afterwards, but I think we're probably grinding into too much detail if we try and address those specifically. Yeah. So any high-level comments, Mark?
I didn't quite get your first question, but let me start with the other two, and I'll maybe take the other one offline, because I didn't quite catch it completely. In general, we look through life of our engine, we assume sort of 25 years. They can go on for a lot longer than that. And a normal total care period might typically be sort of anywhere between 10 and 15 years. Our experience generally is that where we've got to the end of total care, generally they're renewed, and they're renewed on a new set of terms because, of course, depending on where it ended, the number of overhauls that will occur in that period and the flying hours that either the next operator is going to do or indeed the same operator will be different, which will set up a different set of criteria in terms of engine flying hours and cost rates. And, of course, the estimation risk and valuation risk will then apply. Generally, as you get further down, the number of overhauls can get larger because you have to factor in things called LLPs, life-limited parts, which Tony's talked about. Sometimes they're in contracts, sometimes they're not, and that will drive the mechanics around that. But we have good experience on that. But the same
logic and modeling applies. Your last question, one, was, yes, I did a very purist view, which sort of said this was just a 15-year total care on those linked diagrams that I gave you as a generic. It did not then say what happens afterwards with the next, call it 10, 12, 15 years. And you would just add in a linked, an unlinked program, which would be the other graph again that would kick up in the same way, and the two would merge depending on the conversion rate from one to the others. I'll pick up your first question because I'll be honest, I didn't quite get the detail. We're running out of time.
We'll pick that up after time because I'm going to take the last question, just the gentleman at the front there, and then we'll close.
Hi, it's Tim Schultz-Melander at JP Morgan. Thank you for taking my question. It's a two-part but very simple question. You've given us a lot of detail around total care. You've talked about your non-civil aero businesses being sort of standard industrial, and you've got a sizable but growing installed base with some good revenue and cash visibility. I guess I'm still struggling to reconcile the half-on-half cash variation just in terms of the two or three really big blocks, and you gave some detail to Safa's question in terms of half-on-half profitability. And then looking forward, is that half-on-half variation something that investors should expect to diminish over time? Thank you.
Well, obviously, future guidance is future guidance, but we generally have, even historically, had a historic profile of cash improving throughout the year and phases of what I'll call sort of buckets as we go through our working capital cycle. It's more acute for the reasons that I've given this year, you know, in terms of some of the money we're spending on rationalization, higher R&D, some of the capex phasing that we've had. And again, this comes back to also where we are in terms of in the capex cycle of, you know, what capex we've done, creditors outstanding, paid in the year. So it's just where you bring the portcullis down at a balance sheet date. So in highlighting it too, it's just so that sort of no one panics. It's sort of for us, it's business as usual. It's just what we've gone through the cycle. And we're just reflecting to make it clearer for the market that actually this is what it is and these are the reasons behind it. I think as we look forward and without getting into mediums, you know, term guidance, we have always traditionally had an H1, H2 profile that's been loaded predominantly to H2. And, you know, progressively as we go over, you know, our view is that we'll start to balance more. But, okay.
So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. We hope that you found today helpful, useful, and addressed some of the concerns that you have. As I said at the start, we recognise that we're never going to get there in one go. But if you could give feedback to our IR team about what worked, what didn't work, what you'd like to see in the future, that would be very useful. We'll try to make sure we address those concerns and thoughts and issues. We are, as we said, going to have another day, October 21st, in Norway. Look forward to seeing you there. There is a buffet lunch, I think, outside. The team will be out there for a short period of time. We can take some more questions from you individually. Again, thank you very much for your time today and your attention.